Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, honourable members. I'm Lorraine Lotha. This is my real job. I work permanently for the Chemical and Allied Industries Association. You have seen me before. On behalf of BUSA, we are a member of BUSA, and I do certain work for them, but this is my real job for which I am paid. I'm only paid for one job, by the way.
It's called your day job.
This is my day job.
Fine.
I'm pleased today to be able to speak to you about the chemical industry. What I would like to do is use this to indicate to you one of the challenges that we face. This is one of the areas which Herbert referred to, that in the area of duplication particularly, where there's still some areas that we need to do some work. And in presenting this to you, I want to be very clear that we recognize that in terms of consumer protection, this bill has got to be the law that deals with it. However, we also need to recall that we are not looking at this bill with no other bills in the landscape. And in respect of chemicals, we are one of the industries that is the most rigorously regulated, both domestically and internationally. And we believe that there's good reason to keep some of the technical aspects in the existing legislation, not to duplicate it. And it was a great challenge always. I was wrestling all the time with how could we actually make sure that the gap that the department speaks about, that they need to fill in respect of consumer protection, how could we do that? And yesterday I was really pleased by the concept of complementarity that was introduced by Honourable Member Caesar, because that, I believe, provides us a platform, a framework within which we can, in fact, meet the challenge. And I'd like to try today to explain how, in this case, we could do it. Now, we have a number of concerns in that the chemical industry is specifically regulated in respect of the whole life cycle of chemicals. So it's regulated from the production, from the research, from the through to the production, to the waste disposal, to the sale, to the use. And of course, the other challenge that the industry faces is it provides inputs into a number of industries and also is present in a number of consumer products. That, because of that, the duplication in this bill would give us significant compliance challenges. We also recognize the committee's concern. We note from the briefing, the feedback on the briefing, that the committee expressed concerns that even provisions for labeling, it doesn't matter how good they are, they will not address the safety of a consumer who can't read the label. They just will not be able to do so. That is why the chemical industry generally would prefer to see that a product containing a hazardous chemical is not sold to a consumer, to an individual consumer, as far as possible, or only sold under very rigorous control. The example of such rigorous control is medicines, very rigorously controlled. Pesticides is another example. If you look at the management of chemicals in a general sense, there's a hierarchical approach to the management of chemicals, which begins with the classification of the hazard. In other words, you have to understand, is the chemical flammable? Is it toxic to humans? Is it toxic to fish? Is it corrosive? What are the kind of properties that it has that make it hazardous? You then classify it, and we do that through an international system of classification. From that, we develop a very comprehensive document, can be 20, 25 pages long, which is called a safety data sheet. No hazardous chemical may be sold without that safety data sheet accompanying it. We use then that safety data sheet to develop labels, transport documents, packaging. Any other information instrument is used based on the safety data sheet. Of course, the safety data sheet is a difficult document. It is not an easy document, and we are required by law to provide training in the use of the document, particularly in the workplace. The other area of management of chemicals is that you limit the use of a chemical to a particular area, and you limit its use in products. Now, if we look at the laws that we have, if we consider Section 2 of the bill, and we look at the laws that we're talking about, and this is not an exhaustive list, but you can see it's a significant list of laws which address labeling, information, instructions for use on chemicals. Now, the problem that we have, the big challenge that we have, is in Section 2.9 of the bill, it requires that existing laws, such as these laws, must be evaluated for inconsistency between those laws and the Consumer Protection Bill. In the first place, that is a technically highly complex task and very onerous. It's not only onerous for government, it's onerous for business also. It then says that the bill should prevail. In other words, the bill should be the one that you should consider. And I had prepared these slides and submitted them before I had the idea of, I had heard the concept of complementarity. So I had thought, let us ask for the existing legislation to prevail in respect of the technical requirements and in respect of the redress and the management of consumer rights, let this bill prevail. But I now see that that may be also too radical an approach. And what is better is to consider how could we make sure that we achieve the objectives of Section 3 of this bill, in other words, give practical effect to consumer rights, and at the same time make sure that we maintain the integrity of the existing technical requirements, we do not duplicate them, and we make sure that all consumer redress is dealt with through this bill. And I think that that could give us a way forward. The problem, though, we heard many times the reference to the fact that there's a possibility for sectors, groups of sectors, to apply for exemption. That is, in fact, not strictly correct. Because in Section 5, there is a reference to regulatory authorities that can apply for exemption. These regulatory authorities, as defined in the bill, are restricted to very few statutory regulatory authorities. So authorities like ICASA, like the Tribunal under the National Credit Act, like the Financial Services Board. But these laws that I have spoken about that duplicate provisions where there's duplicate provisions are, if the regulator is the Department of Health, the Department of Labor, Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism, they are not included in the definition of regulatory authority and therefore could not apply for exemption from part or all of this law. And that's a problem. So we need to look at that. The other problem is in this section. And throughout the bill, there's reference to there's the use of three other terms to refer to other legislation. There's the use of the term national legislation, any other law, applicable legislation. In fact, the intention is that that is all the same. It's a law covering the matter other than this law. So the drafting needs to be tightened in that area. Now, in Section 22, which deals with the information, how you should deal with visual representation, labeling, we recognize, and this is an area where, after our engagement with government, certainly there was an attempt to avoid the duplication. However, the term prescribed used in this section, as defined in the bill, refers only to prescribed by the Minister of Trade and Industry. In other words, the requirements prescribed by the Minister of Health, Minister of Agriculture, Minister of Labour are not recognised because of the definition. So in other words, none of those provisions are recognized by this bill. And that's a problem, because certainly our understanding is that it is not, and the department, even in responding yesterday and today, have made it very clear they are not looking to take to themselves the power, for example, the example given this morning of recalling Sudan Red and foodstuffs containing Sudan Red. The department doesn't intend to do the recall. All they intend to do is the redress. But in order for them to do that and then have a complete approach to consumer protection, they have to recognize the prescription in the other legislation. So there needs to be some changes to the definition. The other part of Section 22 is that as soon as you can't use prescribed by other law, prescribed, you immediately, the plain language requirement becomes the default. As soon as it becomes the default, in the case of chemicals, you start to have some difficulty. The reason for the difficulty is that the requirements, both for visual representation and wording, on labels of chemicals are in line with international requirements. So you can imagine, for example, we would use, for example, the international term extremely toxic. Has to appear on the label if the classification requires it. If you look at that, you may say, but extremely toxic, toxic is not an accessible word, we should write extremely poisonous. As soon as you tell us to write extremely poisonous, we would need one label for South Africa, another label for export of the same product, and that's a problem. So we need to, it's important that the international requirements with which we comply are reinforced in South African legislation. I want to show you an example of hazard symbols. I want you particularly to look at the one with the tree and the fish. This is a relatively new hazard symbol, and it means, if you see it on the label, it means that the product is environmentally toxic. It will cause a problem, particularly in the water environment. People were asked, what do they think that means? They said, no, it means it's good fishing. And you can see why they would say it. And if you look at the fish, you'll see the fish is upside down. That means the fish is dead. Therefore, it's a negative sign. It's not a positive sign. But you have to train people in this. You can't. That's why we say it's so important to train in the information, the hazard communication, because you would not intuitively know what that meant. Someone would have to tell you what it meant. And these are international symbols, and there's 20 of them. As soon as we say that visual representation, we don't think it gives the right impression, we would then need to work twice. One for domestic, one for international. In Section 53, we again have the problem. There's a reference to applicable public regulation. This is still a fourth terminology, as opposed to any other law which is more widely used in the bill. Another problem with Section 53 is the use of design characteristic in defining hazard. Hazard is intrinsic. In respect of chemicals, it's intrinsic to the chemical. You can't design the chemical in that way. It comes from nature, hazardous. So as soon as you say design, you're creating a construct that doesn't exist. I think, personally, just to delete the design would solve the problem for everybody, because a characteristic is a characteristic, and if it's undesirable, it's undesirable. Now, we had also thought, again, in Section 53.2, that let's exclude chemical products regulated through another law, but as I've said, having engaged further with the department, we think that that may be a bit radical and perhaps more difficult. And also, because to at this point, also with limited time, to decide you're going to exclude a whole list of laws is almost impossible. It would really be a very challenging task. So I think we need to look at another type of approach, which I'll get to. There's also cases in the bill, this is section 58.2 is one, where it refers back to what is required in respect of section 22, and then it suddenly says any other prescribed standard. Now remember, prescribed is meaning only by the Minister of Trade and Industry. So you've got a prescribed standard of labelling, of information provision in another law, and now suddenly you have an additional requirement in respect of this bill for the Minister of Trade and Industry to prescribe. The chances of that being completely harmonised are non-existent. It's just not possible. And you immediately then have a conflict which you've got to deal with. And every time you must deal with conflicts, it's costing someone money. In Section 55, for example, the use of the term standard is qualified by reference to the Standards Act, which we think is appropriate. That is the correct way. But suddenly in Section 58, there's a new use of the term. Section 58.4 speaks about whether the provisions of the other law are substantially similar to the provisions of this law. As soon as you have to demonstrate substantial similarity, you have to do work. You have to put the two against each other, you have to evaluate them, you have to compare them. It's a challenge. It costs money for both for the state and for business. Section 59 is a section which deals very specifically of taking back post-consumer waste. This matter is addressed very comprehensively in the waste bill that is currently before Parliament. Really, the waste bill is a new bill. It's the first time that all waste management issues are consolidated in a single bill. It's going to be challenging to implement. We would really say this is a section not required to protect consumers. It's required for compliance with a waste management bill. Rather take it out. Section 60, we don't have a problem with returning returning goods, but you can't return a chemical because it's hazardous. Because it's hazardous anyway. It's an intrinsic characteristic, so there needs to be some special drafting. This is very much a case of one size doesn't fit all. And then, Chair, what we would like to say is, and I have provided for you in the submission, a copy of the Global Responsible Care Charter, to which we subscribe as a national association. We are the custodian of that in South Africa. And you'll see that there's some commitments around product stewardship. How do we manage our product from the time we make it until the time it's disposed? And we believe that we could take, using that global charter as a basis, we could develop, in consultation with the department, an industry code which would deal with any areas where there could be a difficulty, and that we should absolutely do that, and we stand ready to do it. We think that what we need to do is we need to say, in principle, we cannot afford to duplicate. It's too much cost for everybody. Let's not do that. Let's agree that we must take the technical, insofar as the technical requirements protect the consumer, where they exist, let us accept them. All redress should be dealt with in this bill, except where there's cases where maybe there is some redress somewhere else, but for the purposes of chemicals, that does not exist. There is no redress anywhere else. Let us give in this bill an enabling power, which says very clearly that is our intention, and which allows the minister then to systematically, sector by sector, address those areas where there may be conflict, so that it's addressed through a regulation. We think that that would give you a practical way forward, and all the time what the test is, do the two pieces of legislation complement each other? How will we make sure that they complement each other? And that we see if we can't do it like that. as an industry, we stand absolutely ready to work with the committee to address these challenges in terms of the drafting, and if it would seem that that may be a useful way forward in respect of chemicals, we would be very happy to submit a supplementary written submission. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Comments, good folks. Dr. Rabisa.
Chair, thank you. Thank you. I think, Ms. Lotte, you gave a very interesting and thought-provoking paper to us. The Waste Paper, or the Waste Management Act, is it done by the Department of Environmental Affairs? Who is responsible for that? And then you also mentioned here that the Department of Health, Section 60, you recommend that we delete it entirely. I'd like to hear the views from, have you discussed this with the Department of Trade and Industry, whether the Department of Health has got adequate powers to control and to monitor this particular section of the Act. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rabi. Comrade Lali.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Firstly, in your very first page, just above general, you said the responsible core global charter is attached for information and is not attached. You refer as it being attached for information and is not attached. The other issue on page 2, right on top, you are raising the question of the duplication, lack of consistency in dealing with other regulators in various sections of this of the Act. Maybe I'm sure the department will respond at a later stage on this issue, because sometimes if that is correct, it's going to raise a problem in terms of the implementation at the end of the day, because you need what you call the cluster approach in terms of the other departments, so that we know one department what the other department is doing. The other issue you are raising on page 3 of your presentation, under section 5, raised an issue of the administrative burden could be excessive, the overlapping that you referred to, but you didn't give some proposal in relation to how to address that particular issue that you have identified. And also on the same page 3, the last paragraph, I'm sure it might be a typing error, under section 22, subsection 1A, requires that the any documentation, maybe just a typing error there. The very same page, next page 4, the last paragraph on top, this in turn represents its own challenges. What is the solution? Once you have the challenges, at least maybe we need to address us in terms of making sure that you understand. The same section you referred to, section 22, subsection 1A, you are making a proposal, an amendment there. I don't know whether maybe it's an omission in that sentence. You said in the form prescribed in terms of this or any other law of this what? Maybe I refer to this act or some other act in terms of this. Then you ended there. It might be, as I'm saying, it might be also a typing error. That maybe just clarify for us. The last issue on page 5, under section 60, safety monitoring and recall, we are raising there, it is therefore proposed that section 60, subsection 1A, be amended by the deletion of the term hazard throughout and replaced with safety risk. I'm not sure whether in terms of the proposal fit in terms of the act of the bill before us. Maybe you can just clarify further to us in terms of that particular one. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Comrade Lali. Mentally.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm covered by Lali on Section 60, Safety Monitoring and Recall.
Thank you very much, Mentuli. Comrade Sisa.
Yeah, Chair. The first area is about the returning of chemical products. If I get Mrs. Lorraine's input. She's saying that you can't return chemical products. Now, the thing is, there is a right for a consumer to get a replacement of a product. How is that addressed now if you feel that you know, chemical products cannot be returned? The other area is the recognitions of various regulators. I think in the second page at the top, you make reference to that. I take it you feel that if they, either they could be included in the legislation or some form of reference is done to that, that would suffice if you could help in that respect. Just one other area, although it seems it's quite obvious, but still I'll raise it. The financial implications of conflict. Are you saying then, if there are areas of conflict between pieces of legislation that has financial implications, in what way? I'm asking this question because, amongst other things, whenever we sniff a risk of increasing cost of doing business, I'm sure ours is to ensure that we manage that as much as possible and minimize it precisely. Thanks.
Thanks, comrades. Shall we take a rejoinder at this stage, ma'am?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the Waste Management Bill is Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. Deals very comprehensively with the take-back of post-consumer waste. As far as the Department of Health and Section 60 is concerned, we're not saying let's delete Section 60. We're saying, and it goes also to the question about take-back of chemicals. Of course, if there is a chemical product that does not do what it is supposed to do, it's claimed that it would do X and it doesn't do it. Or, for example, it's a good example is a pesticide. It's claimed that a pesticide will kill a cockroach. You buy the pesticide, you spray it on the cockroach, the cockroach doesn't die. It doesn't kill cockroaches. It kills ants, but doesn't kill cockroaches. Of course, you must be able to return it. But you can't return that pesticide purely because it's hazardous. Because it's a hazardous product that you purchased in the first place. So it's more the reason. Because the way the bill is drafted, if you find that a product is hazardous, you may return it. But for a chemical, that is not a logical way of working. So it's about language. It's not the fundamental principle that's a problem. There's a drafting problem because of the way hazard is defined. So that's really what we're saying there. As far as the Responsible Care Global Charter is concerned, certainly it was submitted in the email. So I will follow up because I would like you to have that. So I will follow up what the story is with that. The question of Section 22 and the prescription, the problem of it is that if, and this also comes to conflict, we have examples of duplicate legislation. We have an example, we have a very practical example in front of us now. The Department of Transport have amended the National Road Traffic Act. Under the National Road Traffic Act, the chemical industry is required to comply with 8 national standards when they transport dangerous goods. These national standards are very comprehensive, set up very comprehensive requirements. The Department of Transport have now said that they want to extend the control on transport of freight to non-hazardous goods, which is a perfectly legitimate and solid objective. What they've done in order to do that, they have taken pieces out of the national standards dealing with dangerous goods and rephrased them. And they haven't in their amendment bill indicated that these new provisions are only for non-hazardous goods. So they also apply to hazardous goods, which are therefore in conflict with the requirements of the standard with which we currently comply. Now that conflict has an immediate cost, because in order for us, we can't comply with both. It's impossible, because they conflict with each other. As soon as any company has got to engage government on a legal conflict, they will never take the risk of doing it by themselves. Never, ever. They will always take the more expensive route and take a lawyer to help them with it. That costs money. It's the time of the company, because all of the time while they're trying to reach this agreement, they can't, they're concerned that they're running a risk. So their risk manager will tell them, until you've sorted this conflict, you can't undertake that activity or you can't sell that product. So you lose money because you can't sell your product. So conflict in law is a very, very negative thing for business. So that we would say, as a chemical industry, we are already extensively regulated, and we are, rightly so. I'm not saying that it's not correct. It is correct. We are a hazardous industry, need to be regulated. But we must be regulated in a harmonious way, so that we're not having to report on the same matter to different departments. We've got situations now where we have to report on the same activity. If you count local authority, province and national government, we're on the same matter, we must write 15 reports. And the format is not the same. It's that type of thing. It's very costly. So we really think that we should do something about that. The recognition of various regulators, we think that it could be quite simply done by revisiting the definition of regulatory authority. The regulatory authority definition currently in the bill is extremely narrow. It only, and it was the government's original intention, apparently it was the department's intention, but now seeing these duplications that still exist, I think something needs to be revisited. So instead of referring in that definition to statutory regulatory authorities like the Financial Services Board, ICASA, and so on, you broaden it so that it extends to the Department of Health, the Department of Labor, Department of Agriculture. And you may not want to list them. I think, personally, it would not be a good idea to list them, because you need to do the work to make sure you've got an exhaustive list. So you have a broad definition which you would cover all of those. Then I think you would have a very solid way forward. Then you would have to revisit Section 2, Section 2.9, you would have to revisit, and you would have to revisit Section 5. And then if you revisit those three, you would have a very good platform. Then you would have to review the rest of the law, and we could certainly help in identifying those clauses, where you would have to make sure that the logic of that approach is carried through in the drafting. And what absolutely must happen is that there must be consistency of terminology in the law, so that you decide you're going to use any other law, or you're going to use any other applicable law, but you must use it consistently in every single section. It's almost as if the sections were drafted by different people. It wasn't drafted by one person, I don't know, but it says if, so that they a little bit stand alone and don't necessarily are not totally integrated with the rest of the bill, and I think that would work quite well. And I think, Chair, it's important we say that there is no law that doesn't have a cost. That doesn't have a cost to business, it doesn't have a cost to the consumer, it doesn't have a cost to government. There is no such thing. The absolute challenge is to manage the cost. so that the benefit to society of that law, because that otherwise you don't need a law, it's about improving the lot of society that you have the law, there's a cost to that. We must make sure that the cost of compliance is minimized and the achievement of the objective is maximized. And I think that if we can do that, then we'll have a perfectly decent law that nobody objects to. And this is the kind of law that needs to have the support of the whole of society for it to work, because without doubt, its implementation is going to be challenging. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, ma'am, on that very hazardous note. On a more, I won't say safer note, are you also there on behalf of PUSA? You may, ma'am. Apology. We also had the privilege of seeing her in a different capacity. So there's a lot of multitasking. The chemicals wiped out the presentation, it seems.
Thank you very much. Chair, in this case, we have tried, this is, as you know, Business Unity South Africa is a confederation of business associations. We try to reach common ground over a broad level. And so this is an overarching submission and deals largely with cross-cutting areas, where areas of the bill which are applicable to the whole of business rather than perhaps a more narrow sectoral interest. In making this presentation, we absolutely recognize the need for the bill, that we need to improve the way we regulate consumer protection. We did, as you've heard, have detailed engagement in NEDLAC, and we have also engaged further with the department, and as the department has indicated, they are considering some of those inputs and will respond to you on them. Now, for us, many of the concerns that we've raised with the department have been addressed. However, a number of concerns still remain, which we'd like to deal with them. And what we need to be very clear about is that these concerns are not about weakening the consumer protection of the bill. The concerns are about redrafting, amending, so that the obligation is clear, and that there are not unintended cost implications which could have been avoided. The big challenge that we have is to achieve the objectives and not have the cost, the high level of cost that we will otherwise have. And we also, in speaking about that, we also need to recall that the implementation of this bill relies very heavily on regulation, which is good. We think that's a good idea because of the complex technical nature of some of the provisions. It's better to deal with in regulation. You get it wrong, it's not such a big deal to fix it. You get it wrong in the bill, it's a big deal to fix it. So it's not a bad idea at all. We have, as an organization, committed ourselves to working with government on the implementation, because we also believe not only do you need the regulations for implementation, we are all of us going to need extensive company awareness raising to make sure people understand what their obligations are in terms of this legislation, and also consumer awareness raising. And one of the areas of consumer awareness raising is to make sure that the consumer understands where they can get what in respect of consumer protection. Because while to take every bit of consumer protection legislation and put it into a single law may be the ideal, it's not practical. We wouldn't achieve it in 20 years. My colleague Cascavaria referred to the research on the compliance costs, and these are real costs that were found in a study commissioned by the government on the compliance cost. This is a very high compliance cost. The compliance cost in the European Union for the same time period is less than 2% of gross domestic product. So it's expensive to comply with all these laws, and unnecessarily expensive. We could achieve the same controls smarter, and that's what we would be arguing for here. Now, if we look at the duplication, there's currently more than 15 acts. I see government in its presentation said 23, more accurate. 23 pieces of law, legislation, we're now not talking regulations. Each of these laws that we're talking about have regulations as well. We are talking about a mass of regulation that deals with consumer protection. It's not to say we don't need it. And it's been built up, it's a body of law that's been built up over time where different departments have addressed different aspects of it. This bill states categorically its aim is to unite fragmented legislation and address gaps. I think that what we have to say that the aim to unite it is perhaps a step too far, certainly in one step. But to make sure that you have a consolidated body of law which deals with every aspect of consumer protection, that is an aim that we could all subscribe to and which could be achievable. But it's not about putting everything together in one pot and saying that's going to work, because it won't. One of the key things for us is that it is not beneficial, generally speaking, to compromise other mandates. We have a lot of, as business generally, we have a lot of experience with compromising of other mandates, where different departments trade on the mandate of another one and it's costly. We also accept that, generally speaking, most of the sectors that we're talking about and that are members of Business Unity South Africa, there is not redress in another law. Technical requirements maybe, but not redress. So that, in a general sense, we recognize. Now, one of the things that we deal with is the way Section 2 deals with concurrent application of laws and evaluation of provisions. Now, let us take an example here that we think would be important is, let's take the state as a supplier of services. The state is a supplier of, or a state-owned entity is a supplier of electricity, is a supplier of water. Also basic, these are basic constitutional right issues. Now, in terms of legislation dealing with water, dealing even with municipal legislation, there's a particular provision made for the subsidization of that commodity. Free basic electricity, free basic water, subsidization of the price at a lower end. As this bill is currently drafted, there's going to be some challenge with that, because this bill covers also the sale of water and electricity by the state. So that's an example. The other problem is that the requirements are not entirely clear. We've always agreed we must eliminate duplication as far as possible, and we need to do the work that allows us to do that. We think that there may be cases where you have a concurrent jurisdiction, and to deal with it effectively, you're going to have to deal with the case as it arises. As soon as you say that you're going to have to deal with the case as it arises, you have to deal with it in regulation rather than in the law. So again, you need to put the enabling provision in the law. We think that as far as the National Credit Act is concerned, the challenge is less because it's the same government department who is the custodian of the law. So as far as the National Credit Act is concerned, we really believe that it should be possible to deal one way or another with the areas of conflict and duplication. And in dealing with it, it may also provide a model, because it's easier to do if it's the same department, may provide a model for dealing with other conflicts. In Section 5, we have a number of concerns. The one is that we recognize, because we've raised this with the department, we recognize that the intention is that the state, as a supplier, should not be excluded. But we see that there may be, and also as a purchaser. The state as a purchaser must also be, as a consumer must also be protected. So we think that there needs to be some work on the application of the law to the state. The question of the regulators is really something that needs to be addressed. And I think, Chair, if you'll recall, that we also spoke about the management, how important it was to manage concurrent jurisdiction in respect of the Competition Amendment Bill. And there was a very robust discussion in NEDLAC where we came to a very solid agreement, which you as a committee accepted and adopted. Of course, it is not applicable in its entirety. You couldn't just pick it out of that bill and put it in here, but it provides some areas of principle which could provide a way forward for this bill. And one of the absolute critical elements of that solution was that you clarify the roles and responsibilities of the different regulators, and you have a procedure to manage them. And we think that that is something that we might need to look at. And it again goes to the matter of complementarity. In a model where you say you don't need to combine the laws, but you must make sure that they come together, working together, they achieve the common aim, we think you could do it. In Section 22, there's a discretionary provision for the development of guidelines. Now, we believe that implementation of this section is technically difficult, and that guidelines should not be discretionary. They must be provided. Because if they are not provided, we will not have a good outcome. And let's remember also the other challenge that we have with this bill. There are 10 commissions. There's a national commission, and there's 9 provincial commissions. Without guidelines, there is an absolute guarantee that all 10 will not interpret in the same way. There's an upfront guarantee. So let's try to address it. Also, there may be more appropriate methods of dealing with the apparent conflict than are set out in Section 22. The definition of, in Section 53, again, we have a number of... I'm happy to be able to say that chemicals are not the only hazardous goods on sale. There are other products that are hazardous. And there's other installations also that are hazardous. So we need to be sure that we've got a harmonized approach to that within this bill. And again, you have examples of concurrent jurisdiction. Now, what we would say then here is, and we would be very happy to work with the committee in this regard, let's see what we did in the Competition Amendment Bill. We did good work there. Let's see if we can't use that as a base and see if we can't develop something that would be useful here. As far as the institutional structures are concerned, we absolutely accept the principle of having these institutional structures. But we think that for them to achieve the objective of Section 3, the consumer has got to understand what his access is, what can he expect from these. The details of some of them, we think the drafting could be tightened. We think that there's challenges in the concurrent jurisdiction between province and the national, which we think could also be addressed in the same way as in the Competition Amendment Bill. We're a bit worried about alternative dispute mechanisms, the outcome of the dispute mechanism being enforced by the High Court. Because we think that, why couldn't the tribunal give the order in respect of the alternative dispute resolution? We also, there's no time frames here. Now, we recognize that that may be in procedures, rules of these institutions, but we think it should be clear in the bill that there is an expectation of time frames. Now we can see that there may be I've listened to the committee on a number of challenges that they feel business presents to the consumer. So I can see that why there would be a support for an approach which says that the consumer shouldn't bother going to the company first because the company is not likely to help them. We think that it doesn't build the right relationship. The company should be given a chance to solve the problem. If they don't, then let's go to the state. We indicated in the NEDLAC report that we all agreed that alternative dispute resolution here is the preferred mechanism. It's the least costly for the consumer. It's the least adversarial also for the consumer. So the consumer is not intimidated by a quasi-judicial proceeding. So we think that there needs to be more prominence given to alternative dispute resolution mechanisms. And of course, where they exist, as they already exist in the financial sector, let's recognize them. Compliance notices, there have been a number of presenters have indicated their concern for a situation which is not intended with the law. There's no possibility of where there is a situation of repeated investigation and finding, no negative finding, that there's not a certificate issued. We think the proper service of notices, we think there is a section 118 which indicates proper service of notices. We think that it should be clarified in that respect. There should be a clarification of the respondents. The section deals with a notice served on persons or associations of persons, which is not defined. We recognize that there may be more than one person doing the wrong thing, but let's understand what does that association of persons mean. There's also a provision that the regulated entity, which is not defined, where a notice is served on a regulated entity, there should be consultation with the regulatory authority. Now that again brings us to the meaning of regulatory authority. That is, it's a very narrow provision in that as a matter of courtesy, the department is saying, if I'm on a consumer protection matter going to serve a notice on a person who is regulated by ICASA, I'm going to consult with ICASA. But why would you consult with ICASA if ICASA has no jurisdiction? And it's the same where there's also a possibility for the regulators to intervene in each other's proceedings. This was problematic in the Competition Amendment Bill. We fixed it there. Let's fix it here. So it's another area where we need to do that. Vicarious liability. Vicarious liability has a particular meaning in our law, and there's a test which says whether vicarious liability exists. It's that the act is committed during the scope and course of employment, and the act is directed or authorized by the employer. Now, in this bill, the act being directed or authorized by the employer is not there. So it's not clear whether the heading is wrong or whether the intention, we've misunderstood the intention. But whichever way you look at it, there needs to be a review of the drafting to make sure that there's clarity. And then, Chair, we have the same problem as we had in the Competition Amendment Bill, is how do you deal with proof? How do you deal with proof that comes from the Consumer Protection Authority, so either the Credit Tribunal or the Consumer Commission? Again, I don't think that we've completely dealt with it adequately in the Competition Amendment Bill, but we're on the road to fixing it. And we need to do the thing here. We can't have a situation where in these kind of offences there's a matter of reverse onus, where the onus is placed on the accused to prove innocence. The onus is on the state to prove guilt. And in this drafting, it's a little bit ambiguous. We're saying we had the problem in the Competition Amendment Bill. We're well on the way to fixing it there. Let's fix it here as well. Then, as far as the regulations are concerned, when we speak about the cost of this, the full detailed cost is not possible to evaluate without the regulations. We therefore appreciate and welcome the provision for mandatory publication for public comment. However, in many cases, these will be sectoral regulations to deal with specific matters of sectors, could have significant implications. Very specific provision exists for consultation with consumer groups. We think that there should be provision for consultation with affected sectors as well. Government has agreed, as we heard in the NEDLAC presentation, on intensive consultation on regulations and implementation. We agree with that, but we agree that it also needs to be with with affected sectors. We're worried about the reference in the bill. There's various references to guidelines or codes, and these will be integral to the implementation of this law. And it is absolutely imperative that we've got common ground on these. There's no provision for them to be published, and we think that they should be. And that they should be published, of course, for comment also. That may be a step too far, but we think it should be published for comment. Then, Chair, we have the matter of the transitional provisions. Now, here we think it may be a matter of drafting. We're not entirely sure, but so there's provision in the transitional provisions that because this bill will repeal certain laws, the transitional provisions then recognize that certain laws will be repealed, but they say for the transitional period of 18 months, we will continue to use the regulations as a benchmark for investigation. It's not possible to do that. Once the enabling law is gone, it's gone. So we need to revisit that. The other thing is that there's an 18-month transitional period, really a 12-month, which can be extended for 6 months. But we need to be absolutely clear that as to what is the relationship of that 18 months to the commitment by the department that they will not implement the law without the regulations. There needs to be a clarity in that regard. And we have a few areas where we think there should be specific, where we have specific drafting proposals, which we have, most of them we've dealt with in the submission, and you'll see also that the we are saying, let's, where we've done well in another bill, let's learn that lesson and apply it here, as we have done in competition. And so we would really urge you to take that as a platform. We, in summary, Chair, we say that while we support the need to strengthen consumer protection, we recognise this bill as the primary legal instrument in this regard. We need to recognise that there are significant legal challenges and burdens that need to be addressed before this is finalised. In this regard, the NEDLAC agreements on duplication, we don't believe, are fully addressed, so they need to be. We need to have the clarity on the publication of the regulations. The implementation is going to be technically challenging. I think we need all to agree that, and BUSA and its affiliates remain absolutely committed to cooperation in order to make sure that the Act is properly implemented. Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very, thank you very much, ladies. Tabiseng, lastly.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I want to thank the lady for the presentation. Chairperson, you know, as I was reading this, not the summary one, but the presentation that they have sent in earlier on, you know, the explanatory notes are really clear, and I'm just saying we need to read more of that. But Chairperson, I've heard from the banking, not the one that were here, association, that the National Credit Act, instead of, the intention that it wanted to achieve at first for consumers not to have, not to have credits or not to buy recklessly and all that, you know, what is happening now is that the loan sharks are actually getting more customers now, because it's very difficult for anyone to access loans from the bank. It's more difficult than it was before. So what is happening now, the loan sharks are getting more customers. And the problem is the interest that they're charging people and all that. I think it's something that we need to discuss, especially when the department comes forward. But I would like them to say more about that. The other thing, Chairperson, that I wanted to ask when we were talking about the vicarious liability, can you just guide us as we go through the bill, which section is that, and the proof of facts, any examples of what you are talking about? You know, for instance, when we're dealing with the Company Act now, there would be a section where it says that if there was a proof that a particular person was not trying to, the intention was not to defraud the company. Is that what you are talking about? So things like that, when it has to be proven by you that you are not intending to do something like that. Is that what you are talking about when you say that there need to be proof of facts and the law should not be ambiguous? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Comrade Ntabiseng. Ntate Sisa Jikelane.
Thanks, Chair. Just as a comment, it's quite striking that the emphasis from both sides is to say that we'll have to rely more on crafting regulations in order to implement the select. Of course, we'll like to get the department's response down the line on that. What also could be helpful is for WOSA to share this cost, this study on the cost compliance as soon as is possible. The 79 billion, which is 6.5% of GDP. Obviously, one is very, very sensitive, Chair, on the cost of doing business, but there need to be facts on the ground, or on the tables, rather. USA is saying that the state should be included both as a provider and a consumer. My understanding is that consumption, as articulated in this legislation, is anchored around financial transactions. Of course, one would still expect the department to articulate, very elaborate on this. If Rosa could just go through this issue once again. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Farida, let's move. Good folks.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. I just want to say, you know, I got some, I think you talked about sector-specific challenges. Now, I want to know if this bill could accommodate those, you know, in terms of our wording of sector-specific, because I think we do have various sectors like the ESCOM and ICASA and others, right? And then you also, in your last slide, you actually talked about implementation in terms of technical challenges. Maybe if you can just comment on that a bit. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Ladies in red, is it blonde and brunette? We are in your able hands. Could you give us those pointed remarks?
Thank you,
checking
Chair.
If people are awake. If I'm not the only one who's still awake, we can see.
Thank you, Chair. Regarding the question on the National Credit Act, you're quite right. The intention of the National Credit Act is to make sure that credit is available, but that credit that is given is done on the basis that consumers can afford the credit and that they know the consequences of taking out credit. This is an example of an unintended consequence, the fact that loan sharks have seemed to proliferate under the National Credit Act, when in fact the National Credit Act was intended to stamp out this very kind of practice. And this is unfortunate because by having an affordability requirement in the National Credit Act, which means that the consumer's means and whether the consumer can in fact afford the credit are actually looked at and scrutinized. And that means that many people have not been able to get credit as they would have done in the past, which unfortunately due to, I suppose, the state of the economy and just things having become more difficult for consumers this year, it has meant that desperate consumers have had to take recourse and have had to take loans where probably it would not have been best for them to do so. So this is also a prime example of where the National Credit Act would prevail and where the Consumer Protection Bill doesn't deal with this issue, because the National Credit Act is a sector-specific bill. It deals with credit, and that's also one of the reasons why you need to neatly delineate and say that credit agreements are dealt with in terms of the National Credit Act and all other matters such as the goods purchased or the services financed under the agreement are dealt with in the Consumer Protection Bill. Regarding vicarious liability, that's section 113. Just to mention the statistics we gave, that was from a report by SBP. They were commissioned by the government, by National Treasury, to do a study, and the study is called Cutting the Cost of Red Tape in South Africa. It's interesting to note that the costs given of $79 billion excludes the costs of implementing something like the National Credit Act. So I'm sure that the costs to date would be somewhat higher. And my colleague will deal with the remaining questions.
Chair, thank you. Later, we will let you have a copy of that report. The
let me deal with the matter of the state. We are speaking only about the state being covered insofar as it's selling a good, so like water, electricity, whatever, because that is what, because the selling of those goods are covered by the definition of goods. So if one wanted to exclude them, which we don't think should happen, it would need to be much more definitively worded. So that's the first challenge. We also think that the state as a consumer is entitled to the same right of redress as any consumer. We don't think that because it's the state they shouldn't be able to get their goods replaced if they were sold bad goods, if they were sold an incorrect solution to a problem, that they should also be allowed redress in that regard. Then the fact of regulations, if you there's simple examples and harder examples or more technically challenging examples. The fact you cannot implement the bill in terms of the time that you may be contacted in terms of getting an SMS message if you don't set those times. So the bill says that there may be times that you shouldn't be contacted, but you have to know what those times are, and you do deal with that in regulation. But that's a relatively simple regulation. On the face of it, let me rather say this. It's a simple regulation. I'm confident that there will be a huge amount of argument as to what that time frame should be. But it's relatively simple. But if you say, let me take the example of genetically modified organisms as a more technically challenging example. Say, for example, the committee decides that they want, that is not currently regulated, that matter is not dealt with on a label, and they believe it should be dealt with on a label. And you now are going to, so you make an enabling provision which says, the same as the previous version, it says that it must be shown on the label. You would need to deal with the detail of that label in a regulation. I think I would be estimating the time conservatively if I said you would be lucky to finish that regulation in a year. Because the matter of describing genetically modified organisms, of setting it out in an unambiguous way,
and that's just an example, but the
department has indicated, and correctly, they removed from the bill some more detailed prescription. But in order to implement, you need to have a degree of prescription. It's just better to do it in a regulation than in a law, because if you do it in a regulation, and you don't get it right, it's very simple. The minister just withdraws the regulation. He doesn't have to come to Parliament or anything. So he can do it much quicker. And he can reverse a ill-considered regulation much more quickly. But it doesn't mean, the only reason you would do it in a regulation is so that you can be quite detailed. Because you often want to be quite detailed. Because the Commission wants to know what is an offence and what isn't, and if you want to define an offence, you've got to very clearly set out the obligation, because the failure to meet the obligation then leads to the offence, and that's a challenge. And if you look at the bill, we have in our submission, if you look at the back of our submission, you'll see in Annex B, you'll see the aspects and the relevant sections of the bill, so on page 45. So on page 45 and going on to page 46, you will see the regulations that are required for implementation, the sections that will require regulations for implementation. You can see that it's extensive. This is not trivial. And the other problem with this, the challenge with this, is you couldn't do one regulation for all of this because it's too much different detail that you would need to deal with. So you would need a number of regulations to give effect to this. because of the current overlapping jurisdictions and duplication, you would have to, before you even went into the public domain, you would have to consult with the other national departments who have a regulatory interest in the same matter. And that is why we're saying it's technically challenging. And it really is going to be technically challenging. So, in our view, it's better not to underestimate the challenge, to recognize the challenge, and manage it accordingly. But it would be a mistake in our view to think that implementation of this bill is going to be easy. It's not. Even in its current form, it's got some very significant challenges which we believe could be fixed. And it would thus reduce the technical challenge of implementation. It would not remove it. There would still be some significant challenges. But once you've got a good, solid bill which is not giving you a conflict situation, you've got a much better chance of success. And we would really urge the committee very strongly to look at these matters very, very carefully. And Chair, of course, as always, we stand ready. You have any further questions, Marcel knows where to find us, and we would immediately be willing to respond to such a request. Because we want it to work. We don't want it not to work. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, ladies. I must just commend you. Your voices are such that they gave an earlier presenter, you soothed him to sleep. It's the quality of your voice, you see. It's very good. Thank you. Good folks, I'm told that we had tea, but the passers-by drank it outside. So all I can give you is a 5-minute body break, and then we'll take the next presenter, Consumer Goods Counsel. So just a 5-minute body break, then we'll get back.
Service restaurants, wholesalers, manufacturers, and relevant service providers. The current co-chairs are from Woolworths and Rainbow Chicken. The membership, local international organizations, currently is about 11,000 companies, and the main board is at MD level. Areas that we cover include GS1 barcodes. As you notice on most products that you ever buy, there's a barcode which gets scanned at retail level. That comes from us. We are the franchise for that internationally. The RFID, which is a radio frequency tags, product data catalog, and traceability. We also have a crime prevention unit, a food safety initiative. We run efficient consumer response exercises on project basis. And as I indicated earlier, I'm from the legal and economic affairs area. Our initial response to the Consumer Protection Bill was, wow, this is really needed. And we had great support from the industry, great turnouts to the Green Paper roadshows, which were held by DTI right throughout the country. We offered to assist in applicable areas. We had indicated what our strengths were and what our particular concerns were. And unfortunately, not much was taken up. And that's why we call it the sad period. The sad period was when we weren't able to deal and engage on these issues. And we found that the first and second drafts were quite controversial. In fact, what the spirit of the Green Paper was not carried through properly. And that's why we felt that we needed to involve ourselves with the BUSA effort to actually analyse on a line-by-line basis the bills that were in front of them. We had numerous meetings with BUSA, and we have had several other attempts at engagement with DTI. But at the end of the day, the consumer law meeting, which was on the 13th of March, where we looked at the third draft, there were still many drafting contentions, and a lot of that's already come out today. For us, the product liability issue was quite a cornerstone one, and a couple of the speakers have alluded to it already today. But our submission, which is a separate letter that had been sent, because we felt that this concept of franchisee, franchisor, small business, there was confusion in there. We felt that it needed to be treated differently. And from the beginning, we've indicated that, and right through, we've been very consistent on this. A franchisee, or even a small business, is a buyer and seller of goods. He has got responsibilities to his consumer, just as he has got rights as a consumer. But you cannot mix the two together. He has a right as a personal consumer, and as a franchisee, he has got different things to do. And if we had separated it, it would have made it much easier. There were concepts like bundle of goods, which were far too vague, because non-food and food products just are not the same. So there can be ambiguities in there. And this makes for uncertain law and uncertain situations in relationships. There were others in the whole franchise thing, including the rental agreements and those type of things, and we had major issues with them. Some of them have been attended to. But one that has not been attended to is the direction of the franchisor. The consumer buys a branded product for a particular reason. They know what they're going to get. They know the flavor of maybe a wimpy burger or whatever it might be. When the franchisee starts playing around with flavors and inputs, etc., the product, the end product, which the consumers are waiting for and prepared to pay a set amount of money for, may change. That is a definite problem for the whole business of consumer rights as well as franchisor and franchisee relationships. Subsequently, we've had an industry affairs meeting where we wanted to discuss and test out what are still the concerns of the industry. And we have noticed a couple of things that, in fact, this whole thing of product complaint procedure and redress information may be all over the place. And it's been indicated already, not only is it so from the regulatory viewpoint, in other words, all the different regulators may have different types of procedures, processes, and effects on these two things. But similarly, the codes of practices that are out there in business may similarly be all over the show. Retailers typically have attempted to organize themselves and give the consumers a clear perspective of what they can expect from a particular retailer. But like anything else, each retailer is different. So even that is not quite uniform or harmonized. So CGCSA, it was suggested, should prepare a single standard template to appear in similar retail outlets. So if it's a fast food one, to have something that looks the same as all other fast food people would get, and similarly, if it's a clothing retailer or a supermarket that they would read similarly, because there are at least 23 categories of products in the store. Now, if I start going through the products, you'd start understanding what I'm talking about. From cosmetics and toiletries, to food, to milk, to dairy, to tobacco. All these things have different codes of practices, often run by the industry sector itself, but not necessarily the retailer. The retailer would have a different one for themselves individually. So we've been requested to approach our main board with a further mandate to develop possibly a formal alternative dispute resolution system for the industry as such. And the question will be put to them whether they should engage or not engage. But the minimal delivery that is anticipated out of this exercise from our viewpoint, and we believe it's quite positive, is that the consumer walking in to the store would have a display which would give them direction in terms of where do they take their complaints and where can redress be had for that particular issue that they might be facing. We would obviously take cognizance of the DTI, SABS, and consumer organizations who are key stakeholders in these particular things. And I have noted that I haven't seen anything from the consumer organizations at this meeting apart from the one statements this morning on one particular aspect. But this is a much broader aspect that we're talking about. So the way forward, we believe, is we'd like to thank DTI for their persistence in this important work. We believe the consumer will surely benefit from a simplified and all-encompassing process, which is what I think Bruce is talking to. Currently, successful self-regulated industries to be accredited and through a SANIS type objective process in due course would be appreciated. And I think we had a classic example of self-regulation at work today when the First Lady who presented said she had a problem with an advertisement, and a letter was sent to the ASA, Advertising Standards Authority. Advertising Standards Authority responded, had a hearing, and found a particular position with a particular question that she had. Now, that is self-regulation, and I believe the consumer rights were enjoyed. The ads were pulled, and that just shows self-regulation at work. Now, that type of organization does good work, and I believe would probably go pass through the accreditation process that's required. And I think that any organization that wants to venture into this area, if they're not there already, should be given the opportunity to. And that, again, is part of the guidelines that Busa were talking about. We need to have clarification of how do you approach it and how do you do those type of things. That's it. If there are any questions, I'd love to answer or assist. But I must admit, DTI have been very positive about those 3 points that I've raised, and they are prepared to engage on them and take it further. Thank you.
I thank you, sir. If you could kindly switch off your mic.
Sure.
Members, let's move. There's that gentleman who won the Olympic 100-meter sprint, Bolt. He lived up to his surname, Bolt. Comrade Sisa, followed by Man Thabiseng.
Chair, I thought we would be told what the set period exactly resulted, but it doesn't seem it was necessarily a set period. There are always ups and downs during consultation because the department is faced with contending interests from different groups. Number one, one is looking at interests that CGCSA was keen to prepare a standard template. There could be just an elaboration a little bit briefly as to what would be contained in the template. The other one is the self-regulatory or the initiative for self-regulatory industries. My understanding is that the bill does allow that. Now the question is CGCSA
considering doing anything as own initiative in that direction. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, sir. Me.
The main thing that you are requiring from this bill is for definitions. For instance, there should be a definition of a consumer. What is it? The franchisor and all that. Is that what you are? Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Mentally.
Just one question. Why would you like to be a self-regulated industry?
Your chance for a rejoinder, sir.
Thank you very much. The standard template concept is basically that there's a suggestion from DTI that when consumers come to a store, they'd see what their rights were, whether it's on a brochure or presented, displayed in the store area. Now, there's a lot of information out there, and typically the consumer organizations that are out there at the moment, SANCU, South African National Consumer Union, National Consumer Forum, the different provincial consumer desks, battle to have all the information in one area to actually explain what are the steps, if it's a particular product or it's a particular service, and how it's going to be handled. And the idea was to look through that and see if we can come up with a template, a matrix that can actually explain it in a simple format for people to be able to understand what they must do. So if they've got a problem with their radio, is it going to be repaired? Is it going to be replaced? What's going to happen? If their packaging is broken, what's happening? If they don't have a receipt, what's going to happen there? And the reality is there are solutions for all these things, and each person is playing it differently. Some stores say they need the receipt. Others say, no, we can trace the purchase as long as you tell us the day. You know what I mean? And these type of things, we need to identify what is the common template that can be easily accessible and understood by consumers, because consumers want responses. And one of the DTR people did mention it just now, they need quick responses. They don't actually want to go through processes. They have a problem and they'd like to be answered straight away about it. And as long as we get that flowing, if there's any problems in that area, just sort it out. Somebody else also mentioned that this whole thing of lifting up to a new level, something that could have been sorted out at a lower level, that's yet another aspect or another win out of this. Otherwise, you'll cram the consumer courts up with a whole lot of things that could have been dealt with simply somewhere else. To answer the next question, we do not seek to become very willingly a regulator or a code of conduct practitioner or necessarily an ADR. But if our members say, please have a look at this, we have to listen. And if they see that that may resolve some issues, we'd have to look at it. But at this moment in time, as I think the second last slide shows, it's just about the template that we're starting with at this point in time. We're just saying make sure that the information's available so consumers have their rights explained to them. And we think that's the most important thing at this point.
Thank you very much. Kindly switch off the mic.
Thank you.
We thank you. If there's anything that we'd need to revert to you, we'll utilize your good offices. Thanks. According to my program, is this the Wireless Application Service Providers Association? I would like to welcome the wireless delegation, and I must say they live up to it. One of their components was earlier unplugged. They had a good nap to be fresh for this presentation. So we are all ears as soon as you are ready, gentlemen. We are all wired up for sound. Speaking about compatibility, we'll get there.
Chairperson, they say that power corrupts, but Microsoft's PowerPoint corrupts, absolutely.
Okay, so, power corrupts.
But it's PowerPoint that corrupts, absolutely. So apologies for this, Chairperson. While we're dealing with the technical issue, let me just introduce myself again. My name is Mike Silber. I'm a regulatory advisor, also to the Wireless Application Service Providers Association. With me is Leon Pillman, the Chairperson of WASPA. Strangely enough, WASP doesn't stand for White Anglo-Saxon Protestant, but a WASP is in fact a wireless application service provider, those entities that provide services using mobile phones and mobile telephony. I'm going to hand over to Leon as soon as we get the documents converted and in a format that can be shown on this machine. Leon's going to explain a little bit about what WASPs do and how they do it, and then deal with some of the specific issues around the Consumer Protection Bill.
There is a hard copy, the submission that you gave us. So,
indeed, Chairperson, just because this is a relatively young industry and not that familiar to people, we thought it would be useful to at least give somewhat of an overview.
Okay, fine.
The systems that we've put in place, which is a quasi-judicial system for self-regulation, has been adopted and is being implemented in a number of countries around the world. So we have a number of consumer protection clauses using the enforced code of conduct. Whatever consumer protection clauses there are, for example, in the ECTF, the Electronic Communications and Transaction Act that was referred to earlier, we've actually strengthened them. Because what we found is that legislation to some extent is not a one-size-fits-all solution. So what our code of conduct does, because it is can be modified on the fly, is as there are technological imperatives that come to the fore, technological complexities, we're easily able to adapt the code of conduct if you've got to regulate the new technologies as they are rolled out across the country. And let me say this, is that although we're being adopted around the world, the code of conduct is being adopted around the world, there are very similar cogent issues and challenges on regulating technology around the world. We're not alone, but I'd say we're probably best of breed around the world. There's probably one other organisation in the UK that does what we do, but I'd say we've done a pretty good job of keeping on top of new technology and regulating that. So, insofar as what we can do, we've got the power to close services, check quality of service, provide immediate refunds to consumers. So, in all, these are a lot stronger and more adaptable than current legislation. So, just to give you a background on South African mobile statistics, because this is a huge industry. Everybody's got a cell phone, and to some extent, everybody can engage with a WASP or the mobile operator for provision of value-added services. We have 32 million mobile users in South Africa, by far the biggest in Africa. 84% of those are prepaid. The relevance of that statistic, of course, is that if you use your phone as a purchasing tool for some value-added services, you don't necessarily have access to a bill, which then creates a vulnerability for those who don't have access to it. So if you buy something on account these days, you get something in the mail, you get it emailed to you. At a mobile level, it's not that easy to display all the statements of the invoicing on a mobile phone. So we've come up with some novel solutions to solve that issue. South Africans are very partial to their SMSs. Use up to about $1 billion a month, and that's growing exponentially. And like the rest of the world, these content services are very popular, simply because the phones and the devices that you're out there are replacing PCs as your preferred mechanism for not only communication, but use of services and entertainment. Phones are very, very clever. So these are kind of the services that WASP provide, everything from mobile TV, interactive TV, voting for idols, for example, banking via cell phones, search engines, payment services, yellow pages, tracking services, news alerts, financial info. Now, all this was under the broad heading of mobile commerce, which is a more modern incarnation of e-commerce, which you primarily buy your PC. And our role is to, as an organization, is there to create a confidence in the mobile device, as it is now on a PC, to use that mobile device as a future payment mechanism, because that's the way it's going to go. Credit cards and checks and all those things from your children and grandchildren, it'll be sort of go the same way as records. And if people aren't happy, confident with their mobile device as a payment tool right now, they're certainly not going to do it, at least willingly, if they feel they're not being protected. So our role is to protect them through, although these are the first generation of services, protect them now so that they feel comfortable using more, buying other services that aren't necessarily digital. So literally buying a Coke, going to a restaurant, paying for something at a restaurant. There are about 170 WASPs in South Africa. Those we define as companies that have direct connections to the mobile networks, because the billing for buying these services is done through the mobile networks, through their prepaid account or through their postpaid bill that they get at the end of the month. Bolting onto those are about 1,000 information providers growing monthly, which connect to consumers via WASPs, acting as what we call aggregators. So those are brands that don't have the technical wherewithal, or don't want to for that matter, to connect to customers through their cell phones, but they have connections to the mobile operators. So those we call information providers, and those are brands. For example, Coca-Cola wants to send you some information. They'll use a WASP acting as an aggregator who will connect to the mobile network, and that link will be completed once that message or transaction finds its way to the subscriber. You've probably seen this on TV or around. There's these things called short codes. Those are 5-digit numbers that are common to all 3 mobile networks in South Africa. And this is a standard technique around the world So 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and you'll send the SMS to that, and you can be billed once off or via periodic billing, also known as subscription services. It uses premium rates for payment, so those are greater than your standard published rates lodged with the ICASA for payment of services. This is what the money flow looks like. Subscriber, for example, will pay for something for 10 rand, be it by a ringtone. The mobile operator takes 5 rand. That's a historical issue because of the retail margin involved in selling a prepaid voucher. The WASP will take a rand, for example. An information provider who provides a service on top of the WASP will take, say, 3 rand 50, and then any royalties and the like will be about 50 cents. So that is a general model. The WASP and information provider, for that matter, could be the same company. But that is a stylized, generalized model of the money flows and exactly how services are sent to the customers. So all these services that I mentioned earlier are pretty complex, and we might well explain what we've done on a self-regulatory basis. And just to make the point that the technology doesn't wait, it rolls out. And you've got to have legislation that is prescient, looks forward, and in the absence of that, I think self-regulation works pretty well. So over to Mike.
Thank you. As you're aware, I act for the Internet Service Providers Association, and that's an organization that's 12 years old. In the first few years of the association and the growth of the Internet, we saw the same manic growth that we're seeing at the moment in the wireless services industry. We've taken a view that we could look at hard regulation, we could lobby to get laws passed, or we could look at self-regulation, a way of actually looking after ourselves. We at the moment fall within a system of pure self-regulation. The state has no role. We're extremely adaptable. We're incredibly reflexive. We allow for coordination. We lobby for acceptance. That's as opposed to a situation of co-regulation or state control. The United States, similar market, or in the same market or industry, again, pure self-regulation. South Africa, self-regulation, looking through the mandate in the ECT Act that we mentioned earlier. The United Kingdom is an example, as Leon mentioned, of a very good regulator working in a co-regulatory environment, working through the telecoms regulator in that circumstance. I don't think the telecoms regulator would like us if we gave them more tasks than they have at the moment, so I'm not suggesting it. The biggest problem that we have with either co-regulation or imposed hard regulation is the inability to deal speedily with complex technological issues as they arise. We believe that in this Wild West arena that we're facing at the moment of new operators trying new things all the time, we need to be flexible, we need to be adaptable. Just to give you an example, we've got an emergency complaints panel tomorrow afternoon. Emergency panels happen in extreme circumstances. It's a novel approach. It will be based on the code, and we will shut somebody's business down because they're doing something which falls outside of the scope of the code, bringing the entire industry into disrepute, assuming, of course, that the facts do support that contention. But that's what generally happens when we have an emergency panel. We can't do this in a slow-working standard regulatory environment because the damages that start to accumulate are immense, both reputational to the industry as a whole, as well as to consumers in particular. So we're looking very much at light-touch self-regulation, looking to provide a code of conduct, not mere templates, but real working code of conduct, protecting children and other vulnerable consumers, creating peer pressure on the rogues out there, and we do admit that there are rogues out there. We impose sanctions, we impose real sanctions, we close services down, we try and build consumer confidence because it's the only way that we can build this industry. The vast majority of our members, in our view at least, act ethically. There are complaints about a few of them. We tighten the rules. We have a code of conduct, we have advertising rules, as Leon mentioned, code in effect from September 2005, with then specific advertising rules since January 2006. Many of those integrate national laws. Some of them are stricter than national laws. We revise them constantly. We look at similar issues in other jurisdictions because we know that if a WASP or an information provider in the United Kingdom is starting to rip off customers, it's only going to be a matter of time before that scam arrives in South Africa. So we start preempting them before they get here. We've also been copied in other countries because we act so quickly and so proactively. We deal with issues like spam, adult services. I know it's not the issue in this portfolio committee, but adult content on cell phones, access by minors to adult content, subscription services, pricing, terms and conditions, promotional competitions, dating services, raising money for charity, using donations by mobile phone. All of these are issues that we try and deal with because they're issues where there's potential harm to consumers. With regard to our advertising rules, we've actually gone media specific. In terms of TV, we require pricing in the corner of the screen. We've indicated a minimum display time and cost for terms and conditions, minimum font sizes and type. Over radio, we have specific terms. In print, even in billboards, we require a minimum percentage size for the price of the service so that people don't get ripped off or are unaware of what they're paying when they're accessing this content. We also have rules for the internet, below-the-line marketing, SMS, MMS messaging, all have guidelines. This is an indication of what we actually advise our members. These are some of the TV rules, where we actually have very specific rules as to what size, what font, what color the font has to be in, because we're aware, as soon as we give any leeway to our members, they will exploit the leeway. If we don't tell them that the corner block must be in black, then they will push it into grey, light grey with the price in lighter grey or in white, and there's the possibility of consumers not seeing the price, missing the price, and getting abused. So we need to be very careful, we need to be very specific, and we need to change, because as soon as one of our members sees a loophole, we need to close it. We don't have time to deal with approvals and processes. We need to be quick and adaptable. Just to give you some updates, in the last 3 weeks, we've introduced a 300 Rand a month maximum on billing on services. If you're going to, or if you reach that 300 Rand threshold, then you need the consumer's specific consent to continue billing. We started seeing some of our members gouging their consumers and going to 400, 500, 600 Rand. On a service, we've introduced a maximum. If the person can afford to pay and is aware of what they're getting, they then have the choice to continue, otherwise the service provider has to stop billing at 300 Rand. We've indicated that service advertisements can't be aimed at children. We're trying to remove TV advertising from children's specific slots. The TV stations, the channels, have made membership of WASPA compulsory because they don't want to deal with the consequences when their viewers are complaining about services not providing the quality that's required. And when you subscribe to a service, there's got to be a confirmation by SMS. So people aren't subscribed to services, so that's continual daily, weekly, or monthly billing, which of course is very profitable to our members. But we don't want consumers being subscribed without them being aware of it, so they have to receive an SMS when that happens. We've implemented a media monitor, so somebody who proactively goes out looking at the media to check that our members are complying. We don't just wait for complaints to come in. We're one of the few organizations out there that proactively goes out and assesses our members' compliance with our code of conduct. They have the option of instituting complaints against offenders. They look at magazines, they look at clipping services, they look at TV, they listen to the radio to get that. We have a set of adjudicators, 8 of us, all of us specialists, information communications technology lawyers. We also have an appeals panel to handle appeals. All of us are lawyers trying to get a fast turnaround. We have the emergency procedure that I referred to. We have pretty significant powers, refunds, then and there, suspension. So you can't do business for a period of time. Fines, withholding of revenue, shutting down a service immediately, putting providers onto some sort of hold list because we consider them to be disreputable. So they can't go into business the next day under a different company name. We actually put them onto a hold list.
and we can expel them from the organization, which means they can't connect to the three mobile networks. That's the ultimate sanction. If they don't go through us, they can't connect to the networks, and they can't do business in the space. What I should also mention is that we've introduced a consumer self-help portal, so you can go and check what services you're subscribed to. You can unsubscribe from those services. We're trying to give consumers, because a lot of the questions and calls and complaints we have is consumers who are unaware of it. We need to give them the option of actually finding out what services they're receiving and how to get rid of those services if they don't want to deal with them or they don't want to pay for them anymore. Also dealing with the question of spam, which we spoke about earlier. Some of the results, blacklisting of rogue services. We've had fines up to 200,000 rand. I see nobody has managed to beat my record so far. So up to 200,000 rands worth of fines we've levied against members where we feel they've gone outside of what's acceptable behavior. At the moment, we're more focusing on closing down services than fining them. We started seeing that our members were actually building the cost of fines into their business model, so they'd withhold revenue enough to pay for the fines that they were expecting. So now we try and shut them down instead of fining them, because we don't think financial penalties are good enough anymore. We get the networks to refund the consumers. We have an incredible power because it's this closed network with the mobile operators. We can get the networks to act on our sanctions. As I mentioned earlier, the TV stations have come on board with us. We're doubling the adjudicator pool to handle the number of complaints. The media monitor is helping us enormously, and we're working with organizations like Advertising Standards Authority and ICASA to implement this. I do apologize for that little block over there, but we've managed to resolve over 4,500 complaints and inquiries. It took 1.5 years to get the first 1,000 complaints. It took 3 months to reach the third 1,000 complaints. As we're becoming better known, the number of complaints and inquiries we're receiving are growing exponentially. We've got hundreds of adjudications. In 2007, we had 85 adjudications, as well as 114 informal complaint resolutions, plus numerous queries. All of those are available on the website. If you want to know who you're dealing with in the mobile arena, you can go onto our website. You can find out exactly who you're dealing with. Subscription is a big issue. We get a lot of questions. Spam, major issue. We had some of the honorable members mentioning the amount of unwanted messages they're receiving on their mobile phones. Unclear pricing for services. Adult content is a big issue, as well as how do I get hold of the person who's providing me with these services. These are the most common issues that we deal with. But as I said, because this industry is changing so quickly, we do need a code of conduct that can change very quickly, which brings us to our questions around the Consumer Protection Bill. Our first specific comment is around Section 36 and promotional competitions. We, in our view, SMS, the short message service, has revolutionized promotional competitions. You know, think about it. 10 years ago, you actually had to post a coupon to enter a promotional competition. Now almost every competition has an SMS entry mechanism. We recognize that this is related to rogues. You know, just for example, the service where the millionth SMS wins a Ferrari and it's a 10 rand SMS service. Well, there are two things that should scream out to you. Firstly, whoever's running the competition is going to earn 10 million rand. Well, as Leon has explained, they're not going to earn 10 million rand because the networks will take a portion of that. But the other thing is, they haven't gone out and bought the Ferrari. They're waiting for that 1 millionth SMS to come in, and then they'll go out and buy it. And if they don't receive a million entries, if they only receive 999,999, well, then they're just going to pocket the money and walk away because they haven't received the millionth SMS. We understand, we recognize the Lotteries Act currently prohibits it. We're absolutely in agreement with the department that those sorts of services should be shut down. In our opinion, we're doing a better job of shutting them down than the Lotteries Board are at the moment. We act more quickly, more effectively, and we have greater power than the regulator does itself. Where we do have an issue with Section 36 of the bill is that many consumers, as well as promoters of products and services, prefer using SMS as an entry mechanism. It's on your phone, it's quick, it's convenient. It has added benefits in terms of the ability to interact with the person who's entered the competition quickly and efficiently as well. So giving them immediate feedback. Where we have an issue is that some of these people prefer to use premium rated SMS. As Leon explained earlier, premium rated SMS using that 5-digit short code, it has one massive benefit. And that massive benefit is everybody pays the same price. It doesn't matter if you're on a contract or if you're prepaid. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, if you're living in Sandton or you're living in Soweto, you pay the same price. A lot of the people who are promoting their products and services through competitions don't like the idea that somebody from Sandton can enter a competition at 5 cents an SMS or at free, with free SMSs, while the other consumers in poorer areas who are on prepaid have to pay up to 1.80 rand or even 2 rand per SMS to enter a competition. It doesn't seem fair. They would like that to be equalized across their consumer base. The other issue is that premium rated SMS gives you a higher quality of service. It's the equivalent of sending a registered letter. The network, because it charges a higher rate for it, monitors the transmission of that message over the network. On that basis, we do recognize that there's got to be some limit. At the moment, Section 36 says that the cost for entering must be the reasonable cost of posting or otherwise transmitting an entry form or device. Now, I know that the mobile operators were here yesterday. They're quite keen on that wording. It doesn't do that much harm to our industry. What we're worried about is it doesn't give consumers the clarity that they need. There could be debates as to what's reasonable. You know, is it reasonable to win a diamond ring worth 100,000 rand to require a 10 rand entry? To me, I would prefer not to get into those arguments. One practical option that we've suggested, we've evaluated national legislation from a number of other countries. One law that we really liked the approach taken was the UK. And the UK says it must be the cost of sending a standard letter or the equivalent, or if you're going to have a payment which is higher than that, there's got to be a free entry mechanism, and there can be no discrimination between the free entry mechanism and the other paid entry mechanism. So if you want to use premium rated SMS because it's convenient, because the cost is equalized over your entire user base, and because there's higher guaranteed quality of service on transmission, then you have to make a free mechanism available. If you're going to charge 5 cents or 50 cents or 5 rand for an SMS, you have to make sure that there is a free entry mechanism available so that those consumers who choose to use the free mechanism can do so. And that's something that the UK has adopted and is, our view, a good practical suggestion. The other thing that we thought we'd point out is that at the moment, subsection 11 of section 36 provides for the minister to determine a monetary limit below which promotional competitions won't be subject to these requirements. We have a concern, and I think it's a concern raised by a number of the other speakers, is this potentially creates a gap between the time that the legislation is passed and the time that the minister actually makes that determination, during which small value competitions are not effective because this limit is imposed. And our suggestion is that we insert a minimum amount, a threshold amount as the Act, as the bill refers to it, which the minister can then amend. We've suggested an amount in our written submission of 10,000 rand. You may feel that that's too high, you may feel that's too low, but that's an amount we thought let's start at and then let the minister make the changes from time to time. But at least until that determination of the threshold is made, there is a starting point. The other thing that I just wanted to say, and it touches again on some of the other presentations, in terms of evolving codes of conduct, at the moment, a code of conduct to be recognized has to be approved. Now, in our view, this potentially creates a standstill on what we've been doing because we move quickly to try and tackle problems that we encounter efficiently. If we have to go through an approvals process, and unless somebody can offer me a time period guarantee that the approvals process is more effective than my timing on this presentation, that we can get an approval through in a matter of days, not weeks, not months, but days, then potentially we have that flexibility. But without it, we have the possibility of rogue services which will negatively impact consumers, and the fact that we have to get approvals from the Commission means that we cause harm rather than doing good. One suggestion is that we look at a services exemption. The other one is that we look at an interim recognition with the possibility to make changes and then get approval after the fact, rather than having to wait for approval before you can make changes required to your code of conduct. And then, just to end off with one of the former ICASA councillors, seeing as we have one of the future ones sitting with us today, just to refer to a comment made by one of the former ICASA councillors that in his view, WASPA was one of the best examples of self-regulation that he'd seen in the world.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Comrade Ntavise.
Person, this was the very most difficult presentation. You know, when you read this, the only thing that they talk about here is competition. And there is something different, totally different from this. So it was really, really difficult to actually... And I think some of the points that they've said there are good points, but for us to grasp and write it and all that, you know, we've had a long day, so this was really difficult. But Chairperson, I just wanted to ask about the competition. You know, other competitions like the SMS competition that is advertised on TV almost on a daily basis is Winikaya, and it helps the poor people to get houses and all that. So I just wanted to find out, you know, as you are opposing to those, which I think some of these competitions are really uncalled for, and they're really towing people's money. What can be your advice as far as this Winikaya? I mean, if you say R7.50, you pay for SMS to reply house for you to win a house, and the house is 500,000, which I think, according to example, it will be 66,000 people who would have to SMS for them, for that charity company to have to buy people's houses and all that. But the other thing, Chairperson, as you know, your stringent measures to make sure that people that affiliate to you, they comply with the regulations that you give them. You give them fines, 200,000 and all that. If you take them out, I mean, are you the only wireless connection? Won't they go to another company? I know that you've talked about blacklisting and all that, but who are you blacklisting them from? Because if they get out of your organization, they can actually join another organization. I just wanted to find out, because I think what you are saying, the fines that are not enough, and you need to have more stringent measures to make sure that they comply. But I just wanted to find out, is there any other body that, I mean, or any other company that they can go to and do their connections? Thank you, Chair.
Comrade Ntavisen, when you say they chow people's money, I can only assume you are saying that they utilize that money in one way or the other.
Chairperson.
Man Tuli.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you very much for the presentation. I see here on your first page, because I'm looking at this rather than that one, I couldn't follow that one. You have definitions here. You say the committee means the National Council of Provinces Select Committee on Economics and Foreign Affairs. I don't know whether you mean us or you mean the other committee, because we are not the select committee. Now, my question would be, how do you monitor that the prices are given to the people? Because I see here you're dealing mostly with promoting of competitions. How do you monitor that the compliance people are getting those prizes? I've learned in some instance that a person was told that he's over 70, he cannot get the Winnie Cryer house. Like for instance, at my age, I can SMS, but at the end, I'll be told that I'm too old to get the house. The second question would be, I think it's page 6 of 11. I don't know where I should start, but let me just read the sub-clause here. It's B1, Roman figure 1. You say here, a winner of the competition, if it is unlawful to supply those goods or services to that prize winner. But this sub-paragraph does not preclude awarding a prize to a person merely because that person's right to process or use the prize is or may be restricted or regulated by or otherwise subject to any public regulation. Can you please elaborate on this? What are you saying here? In a clear layman's language or laywoman's language. Just clarify my mind here because I don't seem to understand quite clearly what you are saying. And lastly, you talk about that you are a self-regulatory body. And you say you are entitled, I don't know, yeah, you are entitled to make an application for exemption. And then you say this must not be restricted to statutory regulatory authorities alone. Can you clarify us on that one? And where does it fall in the bill as well? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Manjili. Gentlemen, you may respond to that in the meantime.
Thank you very much for your questions. Obviously, recursion questions. I'll answer some of the broad ones, and Michael will answer some of the regulatory issues. Just in terms of Winnie Cryer and the value, that is unfortunately part of a court case at the moment, so it's not within our remit at the moment because it's sub judice to discuss what might be the outcome of a court case. Between that and National Lotteries Board, Winnie Cryer and National Lotteries Board. Insofar as your question goes around if you shut down somebody, can they go somewhere else? The answer is unequivocally no, they can't. I put up a slide earlier on how the industry works. It's not like the internet. You can't just go jump hopscotch everywhere. The key to this industry is how you bill people, and it's billed through the cell phone account. That means there has to be some connection to the mobile operator's billing system. So if you want to bill somebody, you have to go through the mobile operator's billing system. You have to have access to the prepaid account, or you have to have access to the postpaid account. Same thing, but the billing system effectively. Now, if the operators decide, for whatever reason, that you can't have access to the billing system, the prepaid account or the postpaid account, then you can't bill them. Now, because mobile operators have made WASP membership compulsory, and if we indicate to them that a service that might be accessing their customer's prepaid or postpaid account is a rogue service and shouldn't be allowed to do so, then that company will not allow to operate and have access to that person. They can't advertise, and they can't access the purse. So the strict answer is, and the general answer is, if we shut them down, they can't open up in any other guise, unless they give the service away for free, which nobody's going to do. Insofar as your question about monitoring compliance, the prizes and the like, we mentioned, Mike mentioned, we've got a media monitor that checks these competitions. We do have very, very strict rules around competitions in our code of conduct, which is, if you want to have a look at it, is on our website, waspa.org.za. And one of the provisions in the code of conduct is that we can request an audit of that competition at any stage. We can suspend the competition, we can request an audit, we can ask for just about any information. So that compliance and the checking of the service is robust, and it is there. Even charity competitions, the charity services, we can check that money is actually going to a charity. So it's not just SMSing 10 rand and off it goes into somebody's pocket and not a charity. Okay, Michael, you have some other questions?
Thanks. If I can just go back a little bit. Well, I don't want to go into the question specifically of Winnie Caiaphas, as Leon says, at the moment that's being dealt with between the board and the competition promoters. I think it's worthwhile to notice that that's taken a very long time from the first complaint. It's been a lengthy process. Had a complaint come through to us as an industry self-regulatory body, the service would have been, if it was urgent, and it could very well have been, the service could have been closed in a day. As I said, we received a complaint yesterday. A panel's being organised for tomorrow afternoon, and if we find that complaint is upheld, that service will be shut down tomorrow afternoon. The mobile operators will get notice of it on Friday. By Friday afternoon, the service won't be running anymore. Plus, we have the power to authorise and to request the operators to issue refunds. Now, I think that's the power that an industry body has when we take our industry seriously. Just on some of the more technical questions, yes, you're entirely correct. That's my fault. This was originally based on the submission made to the port, to the NCOP committee, standing committee, where we were ignored, so I do apologise for the oversight in not having amended that. In terms of your question around making sure that people actually get prizes and what are the requirements, we have certain very strict rules. As much as Leon says, we have a media monitor, we need to rely on a combination. If anyone is involved in an SMS competition and are aware of a situation of somebody refused a prize for a reason such as they're too old, bring it to our attention. We'll certainly investigate it and take action if we believe that there is grounds to actually believe that. In terms of your question around issuing of prizes that would be unlawful to hold, that's the department's wording, and it's wording that we do concur with. You know, the fact that we didn't go into every section of the bill is because largely we're happy with it. The section there deals, for example, with a situation around having a car as a prize. And the requirement there is that you cannot offer something unlawful as a prize. You couldn't, for example, offer a 100 kilograms of dacha as a prize in a competition. But what you could do is you could offer a car which requires a license and requires you to obtain a vehicle license in order to own that vehicle. You could offer that as a prize, but you must make the licensing and other legal requirements around it. You must bring it to the attention of people that there may be some requirements. Then in terms of self-regulatory bodies, not just statutory regulators, that, if I'm not mistaken, is in Section 82. And our contention over there is that we're doing as good a job, if not a better job, than statutory regulators. We're not looking to be exempted, nor have our members exempted from the Act. What we're looking to do is to be exempted from the requirements of going through vetting and approval for our code of conduct. And I do apologise that that's not sufficiently clarified. What we would like is audit us once and let us carry on with our business if you think we're good enough. But don't expect us to come back every week or every month when we want to make a change, tweaking a rule here, closing down a service over there, and make us ask all over again for approvals, because we need to move more quickly than that would allow.
Thank you, Farida.
Thank you, Chair.
Let's move, good people.
I just wanted to, get some clarity in terms of your... I think you've articulated quite well that your self-regulation is a way of saving time and narrowing the bureaucracy, maybe, if that's what I may say. The bureaucracy in terms of statutory regulation, are you saying that is insignificant, or do you say that it is more or less complementing your efforts in terms of your self-regulation? Because somehow I want to know, how does this bill actually synergize your work and make it more meaningful? Or do you think your self-regulation is regulation that is absolutely, can function on its own? Obviously, as I see it, I think it needs to come together. But anyway, perhaps you could just clarify my mind on that. In terms of your comment on reasonable pricing, the word reasonable, do you think you could become more prescriptive? How do you see the word reasonable being changed to some extent? And then you also talked about your 10,000 rand entry level. What parameters did you use to cap this at 10,000? Somehow, I, in my mind's view, I would think for a conglomerate and a big concern such as yours, 10,000 might be something that is just, affordable or reasonable in your view. How do you see, because I would think in other industries, that is medium industries and so forth, they would find it a bit much. So would you want it to be phrased in a way that would be covering the conglomerates and the medium and small enterprises? Somehow I didn't get that clearly, but I would be very keen to know what parameters you used.
Thanks, Farida. Your chance for a rejoinder, gentlemen.
Thank you for those questions. I'll answer some of them. Just in terms of the word reasonable, let me explain the context of our discussions currently with DTI, Consumer Protection Committee, Affairs Committee, National Lotteries Board, and ICASA. So we've put together what's called a SMS Competitions Working Group, which you might not be aware of. And we've sat a number of times. We haven't come to any firm conclusion. What we have discussed, and this is again in terms of the Lotteries Act, which the Consumer Protection Bill or Act, as it might become, might supersede. What we've discussed is in terms of the issue that prepaid customers would be effectively paying more than postpaid customers. We've come to a median number of 5 rand as a maximum entry. It doesn't mean the competition needs to be 5 rand, but the maximum number is 5 rand. So we're not necessarily asking there to be a prescriptive number placed here, because that can come out in the Washington regulations. But that working committee is working on that number. We just don't want to be in a situation where, as it is now, people are interpreting the Lotteries Act. And there's lots of the Winnakaya court case, the FNB court case, as a result of drafting fuzziness, if you want to call that. Which is asking to tighten that up, but in terms of the actual prescriptive number, I think that needs to come out in regulations. And the number we're talking about is 5 rand, and that's subject to lots of additional meetings we're going to have, but it looks like we might even come to that number.
If I can touch on the other two questions, our view is that in the absence of much support, and I recognize based on earlier comments, this is not the committee to deal with the failings of recognition of industry representative bodies in terms of the 2002 ECT Act, which have still not taken place. and it certainly appears that this department is a department that works more effectively and efficiently. That being said, in the absence of regulatory assistance, we took a self-regulatory approach, which we believe has really helped consumers. If the co-regulatory approach that we're starting to see coming up, where any changes we want to make, well, before we're recognized as being entitled to do this, we have to apply for permission, we have to have our code vetted, which we don't have a major problem with, but before we make any changes, we have to go through an approval process. That becomes co-regulation. And our view is, having done it, we think, very well up until now, we're concerned that co-regulation slows us down rather than helps us, giving us more legitimacy. As Leon was explaining, we have the ultimate legitimacy of being able to shut somebody down if we believe what they're doing is to the detriment of consumers and the industry as a whole. Giving us legislative powers or legislative recognition doesn't really top that ultimate power, the power of the pocket, if I can put it that way. In terms of your question around the 10,000 Rand, at the moment Section 11, 3611, refers to a threshold below which, so the minister would set the threshold, and below that threshold competitions wouldn't be subject to the restrictions that are imposed on promotional competitions. So the idea being that if it's a small competition for, let's say, a washing machine or a tumble dryer valued at 2,000 or 3,000 Rand, that may be a small enough prize to allow you to fall outside. Now, in my view, that may get around the question of the entry price, and especially if we set the entry price, but there are a number of other restrictions and requirements in Section 36. The requirement to make records available for audit, for example, is something that we recognize. The department has put that in because they're concerned that people may be operating unlawfully or certainly amorally. On that basis, the idea of the threshold is that if it's a small little competition being run by the local supermarket, as opposed to a major national competition being run by a major national brand, then they would be exempt from some of those reporting and other requirements. And our view is, set the limit now. Some of our members are involved in assisting with those small local competitions as well. Remember, our members deal with micropayments. They very seldom see amounts more than 10 Rand coming in, and even then they only get 40 to 50% of the 10 Rand. They're not used to dealing with big amounts, but they see lots of them. And the idea around the 10,000 Rand was, it's a prize limit that we felt was low enough to not let people go crazy and for people to overcomplicate or to overindulge in entry tickets for a promotional competition. But at the same time, it was high enough to set a threshold below which you don't need to go through the reporting and other requirements that the bill currently imposes. It's a suggestion. It wasn't haggling. We're not suggesting that we start at 10 and, you know, the department will counter with 5 and we'll land up with 7.5. We gave it some thought, but it's just a suggestion. I think the main suggestion to the department is, because there's so much that needs to be done in terms of the regulatory environment, why don't we put as much in the Act as possible, provided it's flexible enough to be changed later on.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. You are now unplugged wireless. The time has come to say Viva Kosatu Viva. Welcome, Ms. Govender.
Thank you, and good afternoon. We'd like to, on behalf of COSATU, thank you once again for accommodating COSATU to submit comments on this bill. We have been engaging, I think, at different parts on this bill at NEDLAC, and it has come through a long process. For us, the regulation of consumer interests is actually paramount. It's important, taking into account the various socioeconomic interests that have to be balanced. And more recently, if you remember, we the committee has considered the regulation of consumer interests in terms of competition law, which actually adopts a very different approach, which looks at the regulation of corporate conduct and behavior within the market, whereas this attempts to target individual transactions and agreements and how these affect consumers. So broadly, we would say that we actually support the objectives of the bill, and that's where COSATU stands, and that's based on socioeconomic implications. But taking into account the very nature of socioeconomic factors that would drive our support for the protection of consumer interests, we also have to take cognizance of the fact that those very same factors like poverty and inequality also inhibit the effectiveness of consumer protection, and more specifically because people who are of a lower income bracket have more difficulties in terms of negotiating, even within the protection of the law, negotiating better conditions or terms and conditions within their contracts. They also have more difficulties enforcing it, enforcing compliance, even if there are problems in terms of violations, in terms of the legislation, whether it's this bill or other pieces of consumer protection related legislation. So we've got to bear that in mind. Further, a concern is that many of the majority of people who are considered poor would be engaging in transactions in the informal economy, which would be very difficult to actually assess in terms or actually address problems in terms of this legislation. Apart from that, and there's a lot of emphasis of this, on this bill on the individual consumer interests, which we, as it indicated, support, but we also believe that it's important to consider and balance these with the objectives of promoting broader public and collective interests. And there would be certain instances where you'd have to play off one against the other, and you'd have to actually weight the interests of individual consumers against a broader public and collective interest. And we will explain that in the course of our submission. Then further, just for noting for the committee, is that the bill also regulates the provision of services, which includes the provision of labour. Specifically, the type of arrangement or contract that we would be concerned as COSATU in relation to services is your so-called triangular employment relationship, where you have a company offering private, for example, like a private security company that offers security services to another company. And then they enter into a contractual arrangement, and the contractual arrangement is a typical consumer arrangement between the company providing the private security services to the company that is purchasing it. But there's a third party involved in that who's not considered a contracting party, and that is the subject of that contract, which is the providers of labor. And this is essentially outsourced labor. Our concern is that if we're talking about a typical situation of labor brokering. We're talking about workers who are typically non-unionized, difficult to unionize, participate in the labor market, and generally are subject to irregular the nature and the conditions of their working contract and conditions are irregular. There's poor income and job security, and it's difficult to actually protect the interests. So in that tripartite arrangement, we've also got to consider that you don't have just the consumer who's the purchaser of the services as well as the employer of the labor worker who is actually the provider of these services. You've also got to take into account those labor interests as well. Specifically on that clause, if you actually look at provisions in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, they hold both the labor broker as well as the person purchasing the services as jointly and severally liable for compliance. And those are kinds of things that we've got to make sure that if you're balancing individual consumer interests on the one hand, that you'd also have to take into account that they're important labor interests in a particular vulnerable group of workers as well. Okay, moving on to page 3 of the submission, just a few comments on the NEDLAG process. We will be commenting to some extent on the process that happened in NEDLAG, and there was a presentation that was provided by NEDLAG today. Our main concern with the process at NEDLAG was that it wasn't a line-by-line consideration of the bill. Essentially, the process at NEDLAG on this bill focused more on looking at the compliance that this bill met in terms of previous agreements on an earlier policy process, which was the Green Paper on the Consumer Policy Framework. So essentially, NEDLAG did not consider the overall content of the bill. So to that extent, we will be actually commenting on other sections in the bill as well, besides those that were discussed at NEDLAG. As a general point, our submission is not comprehensive. We focused more on sections that affect our constituency and broader public interest as well. We also comment on the specific the structure and approach of the bill, which we have concerns with, particularly in relation to the drafting. In our view, and in spite of the fact that we actually support the objectives of the bill, We feel that the bill has actually been poorly drafted, and that while the intentions of the drafters may be different from the way it reads, there could be unintended consequences, and it could actually open up opportunism to counter the very objectives that we're supposed to be protecting, and I think that's what the committee needs to guard against. And just by example, and this is just an illustration, you'll find that throughout the bill, the word "and" is often substituted for where it should actually read as "or," which essentially changes the entire meaning and the mechanism of how a bill would operate. In some cases, it would mean that it would be almost impossible to apply a particular clause. And some of the examples we note here would be like the definitions of consumer, definition of goods and services, as well as the subclause 52, sub 2, which deals with the powers of a court in dealing with complaints that arise out of this bill. Then moving on to the issue on the scope of the bill and its overlap with other sectoral legislation, and that's on the bottom of page 3. We are concerned about how this bill interacts with other sectors, and not to be confused with other calls for deregulation or self-regulation. These are not calls that we actually support. We are actually concerned that the bill is very vague and almost blunt in its approach in terms of incorporating various sectors without actually assessing and providing and clarifying how that will operate in the various sectors and in terms of also the various possible scenarios that are applicable in those sectors. And that is where we would see opportunism creeping in, which actually could actually counter or contradict the interests of the public, and also in terms of delivering developmental objectives as well. Okay, moving on to page 4, and specifically, and this will actually illustrate the previous point that I made. On the question of the definition of goods, here we note that the definition of goods includes, amongst various other things, a legal interest in land or other immovable property, and it also includes gas, water, and electricity. On the question of legal interest in land or other movable property, here we would interpret this as involving either the sale or the rental aspects or rental type of contractual arrangements, which we would support would need to be more stringently regulated. If you look at the way in which real estate agents operate, and there's a heavy emphasis there on self-regulation, And if you position that against questions of access to housing and discrimination in relation to the question of housing, then there's definitely a need for increased regulation and the protection of and the consumer interest in terms of a broader developmental objectives as well. But if you actually look at other aspects of how land could be interpreted, you could have a land or piece of immovable property that's actually subject to the implementation of land reform objectives. And on the one hand, you have the broader public interest developmental goals that you would be wanting to be implemented. On the other, you would be positioning this against individual consumer interests. And in our view, in that kind of case, it's always the interest of the broader public interests and developmental goals that should win out. But that illustrates why this bill needs to be clear as to how it operates, not just in terms of different sectors, but in terms of the various types of scenarios that is also capable of being presented in terms of regulation, in terms of bill. On the question of gas, water, and electricity, your concern is that this relates to the delivery of basic services, and specifically in relation to water and electricity itself, and not so much gas. It also, apart from the question of affordable basic services, there's also a component that relates to free basic services. Currently, the implementation of that by most municipalities is to finance that through a mechanism of cross-subsidization, where you'll find that higher-income households or users have to cross-subsidize poorer households. Now, essentially, if you look at the question of the protection of the rights of an individual consumer as provided for in this bill, you would, in terms of a strict implementation or interpretation, read that as applying an unfair pricing mechanism against a consumer who's paying for goods that he or she is not receiving. Whereas as Kusata, we would argue that the principle of cross-subsidization is in line with our broader developmental goals. In fact, we would actually want to broaden and widen the delivery of basic socioeconomic services. So, and apart from that, the whole electricity pricing and tariff policy structure is currently under review and is obviously being driven by the Line Function Department of DME. So here again, what we essentially have is a practical problem that needs to be resolved. And if we don't resolve it, then it could actually play into situations where maybe opportunistically the objectives of the bill could be compromised. One possible suggestion that we would suggest in addressing this, and we don't think that it's necessarily would necessarily cure the problem, is that we would argue that there would need to be dedicated chapters to specific sectors. We would also call for a dedicated chapter to look at the role of the state in how it plays out its function as a service provider, and specifically in relation to the delivery of socioeconomic rights and in terms of its constitutional obligations. We haven't commented on this specifically in relation in the actual submission as well, but the state is regulated in this bill as more as a service provider, but not as a consumer. What is unclear where you get particular types of state entities who are consumers and who we would argue would validly require protection of the bill. They're not covered in the bill. For example, a hospital or state school. And this is where the practical scenarios need to be assessed. In relation to the definition of a juristic person, I think it's self-explanatory, but we would also argue that apart from body corporates, partnerships, or trusts, you need to explicitly include companies and corporates in the definitions of a juristic person. Otherwise, you'd have to make a case that they fall within the application of the rule when we would argue that is the intention of the drafters in any event. Moving on to page 7, on the question of interpretation, and this is where we also find our concerns in relation to the sectoral conflicts playing out, and more specifically sub-clause 2.9, which states that the provisions of this bill, or when it becomes an act, will prevail against conflicting provisions of another act if both provisions cannot be applied concurrently. We find that this type of drafting is actually quite problematic. It seems to be now a creeping tendency in terms of the approach that DTI has. It was included in the Companies Bill. I think it was more acceptable in the Companies Bill because it operated within a constrained mechanism where it dealt with more in terms of corporate governance and how companies can be, for example, established, created and dissolved, or the various accountability mechanisms such as reporting. Here, it would start to, without actually defining the particular scenarios or practical mechanisms of regulating different sectors or addressing concurrency, it basically provides a broad clause and then tries to cure it by saying that it will prevail over the legislation. And we would argue that it should be actually deleted, and that rather there needs to be either dedicated chapters, as we've indicated before, dedicated chapters to specific sectors, and or you amend the other piece of legislation that would actually just give more clarity to the application of the bill. We also note that Section 2.9 is in direct conflict with Section 2.10 of the Labour Relations Act, which in itself provides that in the case of the interpretation of any labour legislation, or specifically only in terms of employment matters, that the provisions of the LRA would prevail. So if we had to position the example of where we'd use the labour brokers, the question is then that you've got a contract that has employment implications but is also a commercial contract. So then what would be the case? Because you've got two conflicting provisions that both say that they would prevail. Just to note, on the LRA, this wasn't an approach that was adopted by the Department of Labour as a wholesale approach where all labour legislation would prevail. You'd find, if you look at the Basic Conditions of Employment Act and the Employment Equity Act and Skills Development and other legislation, you find that they do not have a clause that says that that particular legislation prevails. It's only the LRA. And the idea is to ensure that there isn't any indirect consequences of amendment of employment conditions that happen inadvertently through other legislation. So again, yeah, accordingly, on that basis, we would call for section subclause 2.9 to be deleted and to be addressed through other mechanisms, practical mechanisms that actually apply the bill more accurately and more clearly. Moving on to the question of the purpose and policy of the Act, which is on page 8, and which is covered under Clause 3 of the Bill. Essentially, Clause 3 says that it's aimed at addressing the disadvantages broadly, the disadvantages suffered by people with low incomes, and it also identifies people of particular categories, for example, disabilities. This is a very progressive objective in which we would support. It also includes other objectives such as promoting fair business practices, which was the subject of detailed discussion at NEDLAC. And after much consideration, there was an agreement that there needs to be a corresponding provision which would state and make it clear that nothing in the bill would be construed as constraining the scope of government to drive fair labour practices, and we would argue that that should be included in and amended and inserted into the bill. Further, we would also call that the purpose of the bill be extended to explicitly provide for the promotion of compliance with social, ethical and appropriate environmental health objectives, which, if you look at the questions around labelling and accountability and providing for rights of consumers, that's essentially what the objectives are trying to deal with, but it doesn't explicitly identify it here under Clause 3. On the bottom of page 8, the submission deals with Clause 5, which covers the application of the Act. And our comments are specifically in relation to 5.2a, which relates to services that are promoted to or supplied to or supplied at the direction of the state, and basically says that these are exempted from the bill. And here, essentially, that means that the state where it's construed as a consumer is excluded from deriving protection from the bill, but it leaves intact the its obligations as a service provider. We would support, you know, the regulation of it as a service provider, but obviously, as we'd indicated before, with the emphasis on ensuring that this doesn't override its scope to drive public interest and developmental and socioeconomic objectives, but would also call for the protection of state interests as a consumer. There are times when the state, particular state utilities, or state hospitals, or state schools, for example, may be vulnerable and would need the protection as well. And it's not just private individuals. Under subclause 5.6a on page 9, which was also the subject of discussion and concern at NEDLAC, particularly for labour, 5.6a provides that the supply of any services in the ordinary course of business to any of its members by a trade union would be classified as a transaction between a supplier and consumer. Now, our concern here was that the normal functioning of a trade union is regulated in terms of the Labour Relations Act. In fact, if a trade union is found to lack independence, it can be deregistered, and rightly so. In discussions with the department, they have argued that the intention isn't to include those ordinary services, but other services that are more commercially related to trade union activity. But as the clause currently stands, it's worded very broadly, and it forces us to challenge the question of ordinary provisions or ordinary services that are provided by trade unions in terms of servicing of membership, which we believe are adequately covered in LRA, and if they need to be amended, need to be amended in the context of the LRA, where the understanding is that we're not dealing with a commercial relationship where there's a service between members and trade unions. This is one that's essentially supposed to protect a constitutional right. On page 9 and 10, which relates to the clause, the clauses dealing with the rights of equality in the consumer market, this is dealt with under Part A of the bill and is covered under clauses 8 and 9 of the bill. COSATA supports clause 8, which provides us a very detailed provisions prohibiting the implementation of unfair discrimination marketing practices, and this relates to various aspects, whether it's differential pricing or exclusionary acts or targeting of different groups based on grounds that are identified in the Constitution. So for obvious reasons that are self-explanatory, we would support that clause. Clause 9 then goes on to stipulate reasonable grounds where differential treatment can be allowed, essentially where it's actually classified as fair discrimination and would be allowed in terms of the Constitution. And specifically lists services that are relevant to specific age groups or persons of a specific gender. And we would support that again as well. We also think that this needs to be expanded to ensure for an explicit provision for special facilities for those people with disabilities, and this would also fall in line with compliance with the Constitution. Further, we think that it's necessary, while you're prohibiting unfair discrimination, to at least provide some explicit proviso that it would not be construed as unfair discrimination where the object of a specially targeted service is aimed at addressing historical inequalities or to further public interest. And this is not catered for explicitly in the bill. On the question of product labelling, which is dealt on the bottom of page 10 and covered under clause 24, we don't have any provision except to indicate that we actually support the provision for labelling and prescriptions of regulation in relation to trade description. Apart from the question that this promotes consumer choices in respect of the quality of goods and issues around health and safety, it also would promote, also can play a fairly important function in promoting more socially conscious decisions. And here, if we draw link to the labeling of origin rules as well as the Proudly South African campaign. It gives consumers an option to choose locally manufactured jobs, locally manufactured goods, and thereby support local job creation, which with high unemployment rates is obviously something that is desirable. On page 11, we deal with alternative work schemes, which is covered under clause 37 of the bill. Essentially, this relates to an area of, I think, of atypical work, which is almost informal work. The objectives of this clause we support because it's obviously to try and protect the exploitation of unemployed people who often fall victim to these fraudulent work offers or schemes. And you know, if you just drive down a street, you would often see a notice or on a placard or in the newspaper which advertises fairly favorable remuneration for minimal hours put in, and doesn't disclose questions of the uncertainty and of the work. And the bill to this extent forces and compels these schemes to disclose the extent of the uncertainty of the work and the nature of the business activity as well as the income generated in addition to the contact details and the name of the business. In addition to this, we would call for further amendments and specifically disclosures. You'll find in most types of these alternative work schemes, workers are often required to make their own contributions to costs, whether it's the provision of tools or facilities or equipment or just an upfront provision of capital. And this needs to be disclosed upfront in any kind of advert, which then would actually help them help inform them as to the real nature of the work. The other issue that needs to be disclosed is the question of whether or not remuneration is salary wage-based or if it's commission-based. And most times you'll find that it's actually commission-based, and it would require an immense amount of success, which is highly unlikely in that context, to be able to earn the kind of income that's normally advertised. On page 11, which covers the question, which deals with the question of liability for damages caused by goods, first, the submission comments on clause 61 sub 1, which deals with the exclusion of the liability of a supplier for damage caused by goods which would not be applicable to, with GMOs. We are actually concerned about the exclusion of GMOs. In fact, we are calling for that clause to be deleted and the application of this bill to products that are associated with GMOs. And if we look at the Genetically Modified Organisms Act, the focus on liability there is on the end user and doesn't actually relate to other parties in the supply chain, which this bill also focuses on. It actually doesn't just focus on the end user or the end retailer. It also focuses on others in the supply chain who may also be responsible and also have obligations to comply with. So we would argue either that this be brought in back into the bill or specific amendments be made to the Genetically Modified Organisms Act to ensure that there is actually some kind of consistency thereof. We would also call for the reinstatement of an earlier version of the bill, the reinstatement of section 29(1)(a) numeral 1, which was an earlier provision of a much earlier draft of the bill, which compelled disclosure in the labeling and the packaging of a product in relation to the presence of GMOs, and we think that it's important. If there are technicalities around practical technicalities, these can be resolved in the regulations, and we strongly believe that these need to come back in. On the question of the limitation of a liability for claim for damages, we note that under subclause 61(5), a supplier will not be held liable for claim if a claim for damages are brought more than 3 years after the death or injury of a person. We actually think that this blanket exclusion is of concern, and that there should at least be made some kind of provision for justifiable cases where you should condone a late claim. If you're talking about injury or death, these could actually be the reasons why somebody is unable to meet that three-year period. Also, if you're talking about particular individuals who operate within a certain socioeconomic context, then the question of lack of information also plays a part. If you look at the question of workers who, for example, travel across provincial boundaries and work for years and often without contact with family members, sometimes a person may be killed at work or whatever, or for whatever reason, and their next of kin are not informed because there's no contact details. So which means that here you're talking about a particular example where there's a justifiable reason to look at reasons for condoning a late claim. Okay, the last, in conclusion, the last clause that we deal with is clause 111. Of the bill, which focuses on criminal penalties in the bill. Here we're actually calling for the NEDLAC agreements on criminal sanctions to be incorporated into the bill, and more specifically that the current penalty regime applicable under the Merchandising Marks Act, which this bill intends to repeal, if that can be in the interim applied to the textiles and clothing and footwear industry. In that intervening period, there would be a suspension of the administration fine provision in the bill as well. That's in relation to current products, and only new products would then be subject to the criminal provisions and penalties in the bill. We have further asked for the space and time for us to actually look at and review the criminal penalties in the bill currently to ensure that there's a more harmonious regime, because the current clauses in the bill are actually not acceptable. They actually are not stringent enough, and further, they would actually only be applied in the case of when an order of a tribunal has been contravened, and we actually think that there are other instances when they should be applied as well. Okay, thank you. That concludes the submission.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Members, comment, questions? Mentally followed by Ntate Jasmine, followed by Ntate Chigelan. Really?
Thank you, Chairperson. Ya leboga modula stool. In page 5, starting from page 4, land and or immovable property. You say, however, we have a serious concern as to how consumer rights provided for in the bill will be resolved in the case where this conflict that of land reform objectives. I don't know whether you refer to restitution or redistribution, or maybe you can elaborate a bit on how do you envisage conflict in relation to land redistribution. And just clarify us on that one a bit, or make an example so that we understand exactly what you mean. And secondly, my mind is tired. Yeah, on genetically modified organisms. You say you are concerned about the exclusion, since it means that the liability for damages associated with GMOs will remain with the Genetically Modified Organisms Act. Now, which adopts a different approach from the bill in that liability therein lies with the end user and not with the parties in the supply chain. And I want us to discuss this, but maybe at a later stage, not now, so that we look at exactly where the liability lies. Because really, if you look at agriculture, there's nowhere where the consumers are protected. Even when you look at the health, there's just that right of recalling the product, but nothing else happens. But I think it opens up for a platform that we might further debate this, because really, if the GMOs are causing illness or something to our people, then we need to address this particular issue of genetically modified organisms. Let me leave the other one because I don't know where it is. Okay. For now, thank you very much.
Mentally, thank you very much. Tate Hasman, let's move, good folks. We still have one more presentation. I want you to move with speed, precision, and focus. We are not all mentally, you see. Mentally has got 7 score years to a credit. Okay. That is 70.
Page 13, Chairperson. Kusatu says, accordingly, we are calling for amendments to reflect the neglect agreements above. And I know that there are protocols at NEDLAC that constituencies should abide by. Now, could you elaborate what agreements are these in this regard so that we're clear? And I know that protocols regard new other issues that the constituents should not bring in new other things that are not agreed upon. Page 12, late claims. I think we need to consider, Chairperson, as to what this would, you know, the consequences of that of section or subclause 61(5)(d), the consequences thereof, because we have had cases, as Kosatria said, many cases that were brought up very late, especially cases that affected workers, asbestos, for instance, and the care, you know, we can actually talk about many. So I think we would have to consider that and see how we move with that. Subclause 5-6A in your submission, I looked at that in the bill, and I'm a bit taken aback too, because organizations that are highlighted there, trade unions, clubs, they can be clubs, associations, society. Then, you know, when you say society, and also I saw something like cooperatives or what? No, it's not in here. And other collectivities. And I think we would need, because some of those organizations are also regulated by their own constitutions and so on, so like trade unions. And that now the services would be tend to be you know, services that must be regulated by this act. Yet there are other acts that are actually regulating labor relation matters and also organization like societies. If I understand society, society abomme, yo mama society, we would have to actually look into that. Chairperson, Chairperson, the other one, well, Mandula has spoken on the land, land redistribution and other things related to that. The cross-subsidization from the rich to the poor on the issues of gas, water, and electricity. Maybe we'll have to attend to that as well and see how that affects that developmental intention of the state. But to COSATU, I would want to just check whether you would agree that the state should be regarded as both service provider and as consumer. Consumer, given the reasons that you outlined, right? But on the other side, would you not agree that the state organs should be regarded as service providers? Much that you would find that the state is obliged to give service regarding water supply and all those that you mentioned here, including housing. Yesterday we spoke about furnishing for members of parliament, which furniture you would find that it's not a furniture, it's just a phone call, you know. And for those reasons, shouldn't the state be held accountable? And the other issue, on your first part, page 2, when you dealt with this, the outsourcing of labor of workers, and that the workers would not be involved in the contractual arrangements between the employer and this other middle person when those arrangements are made. I don't know whether this should be dealt with under this bill. I'm not so sure. Or whether it's either that should be dealt with under the provisions of the Labor Relations Act, and also be, or perhaps maybe it should be the duty of us not us here as a committee, but the organized labor to unionize those workers so that they would actually get recognition agreements. From that they would be able to bargain for themselves under the umbrella of a union, so that they can actually, which is the case with many other employment arena. So I'm not so sure whether this must be dealt with under that. Last, Chairperson, section 1 of the bill, COSATU. I just want to hear your comment on this one. The provisions under 1C. 1C, where the bill excludes certain other legislation like Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act, Banking Services and others. Most importantly, the Long-Term Insurance Act, and Short-Term Insurance Act. Are you in agreement with that? Because one thinks that those services are the services that negatively affect the workers in particular, whereby some policies would be done away with without their consent, and they would also lose whatever they invested, whether it's life policy and other things. So are you in agreement with this provision? Thanks, sir.
Ntate Hasman, thank you very much for your contribution. I just want to make sure that we all followed you correctly. On a previous occasion, Member Kuno was kind enough to explain to me what Fionkong means. And she said that it refers to anything of inferior or fake quality. So when you use it in terms of the furniture that you have been issued and say it's Fionkong furniture, I surmise that you are referring to the inferior chipboard quality that you have been given there. Am I correct?
Chair, you are correct, because that is a layman's language.
Okay.
To describe the inferior product or cheap product. Thanks.
Thank you. Comrade Sisa, you are next.
Yeah, Chair, the first one is around page 3 and 4, around the broadness of the bill. My understanding is that at times the bill has got to be rather broad, save to elaborate on certain areas within the regulations. Wouldn't COSAT be happy if you could have some of the areas that it is raising to be elaborated in detail in around regulations? The other area is the issue of overlap. My understanding is that there are exemptions at times. Does COSATU believe that the exemptions that are provided inadequate? In page 5, reference is made that there are compelling reasons for providing a dedicated chapter covering the role of the state. I'm sure that is fine. Safe, Chair. One would have assumed then that would have helped us with not necessarily the technical clause, or just an example of what could be included in that chapter regarding which would be dedicated to the state. In page 7, around the status of the act, or the bill, let me say, vis-a-vis others, can you consider comments about how does it see the bill? Well, to us, the impression that has been given that the bill plays an apex nature, or is that of an apex character vis-a-vis other pieces of legislation that deal with consumer issues, but obviously harmonize with those bills as well, or laws, let me say. What's COSATU's position on that? The last one, Chair, is there seems to be a reference a couple of times, if not two or three times, that there are certain amendments that should reflect neglect agreements. Now, there was even a presentation from NECLEC itself.
Now, is the implication that we are missing something here, that because one would then expect that everything that's presented here, either as an area of agreement or disagreement, should be presented as accurate as possible. But similarly, COSATU, page 13 and an earlier page, you know, it makes very specific reference to NEDLAC agreements. Thanks, sir.
Companero Cesar, thank you. Mefarida.
Thank you, Chair. I think we're always quite anxious to hear the voice of COSATU. But I have to admit that I'm quite concerned and worried with regard to your, you know, candid statement to say that the bill is poorly drafted from a technical point of view. I get a bit concerned because if that is the case, then I would really like to hear a bit more in terms of specifics. Because it becomes, you know, we need some precision here, because if that is the case in your view, it is a concern for us. And then I think in terms of, you know, you've mentioned something on gas, water and electricity, and I think you gave me some examples when it was tea time. That seems to be a concern, but I just want to know from you that do you think this covers all the sector-specific areas? Because I don't think it covers all the areas, because ICASA and all those, you know, would be in a different category perhaps. I don't know, you have to tell me. Yeah, I think I agree with your GMOs and many of the issues. Thank you.
Bye. Madam Govender, your chance for a rejoinder.
On the question of land and immovable property and how it potentially would clash with consumer rights, I think this also comes from our ongoing struggle just to implement land reform. You know, we've just had the expropriation bill now stalled. And this we would see as, and we're not saying remove regulation of immovable property. In fact, the opposite. We actually want immovable property to be regulated in terms of consumer protection. But it needs to be sufficiently differentiated to ensure that it doesn't compromise land reform targets. And I think experience reflects that opportunism will prevail, and that even this legislation could possibly be used where, for example, as a claim made that there's an individual consumer right that needs to be upheld. If I'm not mistaken, I think there was a member of parliament who bought land that was subject to a land reform process or was subject to land claim, but I can't remember the exact name, but there was a case, wasn't this committee, otherwise I wouldn't mention it. But on the question of whether or not it would relate to redistribution or restitution, it would relate to both. Probably less to do with restitution now as that process closes, but and more to do with redistribution, because if you identify land for purposes of redistribution, then invariably it's going to be a question of the property clause combined with an individual consumer right. And I think a sufficiently differentiated or limited application of the clause could actually address that. On the issue of the NEDLAC agreements, and I'm going to deal with both questions that reflect on the NEDLAC agreements, that dealt with the NEDLAC agreements. The one was whether or not the NEDLAC agreements that we've referred to are reflected in the bill, and we would say no, the agreements are not reflected in the bill. And I think that the department has to answer to as to why it has not been reflected, maybe because it was a later agreement, but obviously we can't bind Parliament at this stage, but we're actually making a very urgent call that that be included in, because it does reflect agreement between constituencies that includes government as well. Regarding the question of the penalties that the NEDLAC agreement covers, the first problem that we had noticed was that I think this is more in line with the emphasis on so-called decriminalisation, and we've been critical of that even in the Companies Bill process, where we said decriminalisation tends to be a concept that's only adopted within the corporate sector, in spite of the fact that apparently we are the crime capital of the world when it comes to white-collar crime. And it's not a general principle that's adopted across the board as a progressive principle focusing on rehabilitation and other aspects. The amendment or the repeal of the Merchandising Marks Act actually effectively reduces the criminal sanctions in that act and actually applies lesser sanctions and focuses more on administrative penalties. And basically what the bill says is essentially that your real criminal sanctions only are affected or implemented once an order of the tribunal has been contravened. So, for example, it's more like almost like a contempt of court kind of penalty. So it's not actually ascribing the seriousness of the offence to the act itself. So, for example, if there's fraudulent activity where you label something incorrectly to mislead consumers, you know, that isn't in itself the considered to be the penalty, but more a question of something that you could compare to a contempt of court. And we think that actually that trivializes the offences that the bill attempts to deal with. So for that reason is why we'd want it to be dealt with here. The discussion that NEDLAC had initially, because the Merchandising Marks Act is more stringent, couldn't come to agreement that those penalties would apply to all sectors. But particularly because labeling has, and labeling on the question of labeling of origin has been applied we'd like it to be applied more rigorously, but has been applied more in the textile and clothing sector. We'd argued that it should be continued to be maintained and applied there in the interim process. And in during that interim, there needs to be further discussion on the mechanisms for penalizing individuals who actually violate the provisions of the bill. We had argued for a 12-month period. And that eventually would mean that you'd have a more comprehensive clause dealing with penalties that would apply to all sectors. If the 12-month period would lapse, then in the interim, we'd have a further interim period where the criminal sanction for textile and clothing industry would become the default position as opposed to the administrative penalty clause. And then we'd also then focus on dealing with the penalties through regulations. That was the agreement, isn't it? At NEDLAC.
Dr. Hasmini, I'll give you a chance for further. I would like to give the presenter the opportunity to answer all questions and where we feel that there are aspects that we need further clarity on. I'll duly give you the chance to do so. You may continue, ma'am.
Okay. On the question about whether or not the state should be regulated as a consumer and service provider, do you agree that the state should be regulated and how the state should be protected from consumers? In terms of the state and service provider, while you are arguing for the protection of the responsibility, in terms of delivery of water and same services as well. So we wouldn't argue against. In fact, we actually would call for them to be regulated and held accountable. As for a dedicated clause, I think what would have to be done would be practically the clause would have to be break down the various, it would possibly have to look at the different sectors, but we also have to look at the role of separate the role of the function of the state as a consumer versus a service provider. And obviously there needs to be a certain consistency between things like the Public Finance Management Act, things around tendering as well, and we need to actually resolve any problems that would arise there. But that would be the start the beginnings of a clause that would actually delineate the approach would be. On the question of outsourcing of labour and whether or not this should be dealt with in this bill or the LRA, the problem we have is that the outsourcing of labour, the arrangement between the purchaser of the contract and that is actually a commercial contract. So for that purpose, you have the person who's receiving those services, who's a consumer and receives a certain amount of protection, but is also at the same time on a day-to-day basis responsible for oversight of businesses who are Kusada would strongly agree with that there's a need for unionization of these particular categories of workers. It remains a very difficult challenge for us. Contrarily to labor legislation, you have some labor brokers in violation of laws actually compelling workers to sign agreements that they should not join unions. They move them around as well, so which means then that you don't have access, as easy access to them as when you go to a single factory and you actually organize all workers on the shop floor. You'll find that, for example, security guards get moved from one facility to another facility at different times, and that actually undermines the unionization. But this does not actually remove our obligation to unionize them. We just have to obviously find a way to deal with that practical problem. On the question of the inclusion under services, the definition of services of banking, financial advisory services, unless we're reading it incorrectly, the bill actually includes that in the definition and actually holds them in terms of, because it says services includes but is not limited to, and it lists those various aspects, and under C it says is not limited to any banking services or related similar financial services. So our reading is that it includes it, and we would support the inclusion. If we look at what happened with the outcomes of the banking inquiry, and if we look at the issue around Fidentia, there's no way we would argue against more stringent regulation of such institutions. On the question of the broadness of the bill, our main argument here, and this is not, as we said before, to call for deregulation or self-regulation or to reduce regulation in any way, is that we need clarity, and the bill in its application needs to be clear and provide certainty. In some cases, in providing that clarification, we may, once we understand how the differences would be resolved between this bill and other legislation, we may even call for more stringent regulation. So it would actually depend on a case-by-case analysis of the different sectors as well as the particular scenarios that would be possible. On the question of the poor drafting, we gave some examples, and this happens throughout the bill. I think we can probably do a complete list, or maybe it actually should be done, where if you have a list of characteristics or factors that need to be complied with, the use of the word "and" has been used. And you can, if you look at, for example, service, and you look at between F and G, you'll find the word "and" is there, and you'll find that they include very different services. If you look at the word "goods," it also does that, and in "goods," at least in the question of services, it says it includes those services. Whereas if you look at the word "goods," it actually says it means, and it lists a certain number of goods, and then it uses the word and, which means that strict reading means that it's limited to that. Now, I can't remember the exact case, but there was once a case that dealt with, I think it was the extension of Security of Tenure Act, where a court strictly read the application of various factors which would trigger the implementation of a protection of a claimant in terms of ESTA. And the intention behind the legislation was that a single factor was supposed to trigger that. And it was actually incorrect drafting not to have to put the word or in, they'd use the word and. And that had the unintended consequence of a court deliberately, I would argue, misreading that. So we don't want to create unintended consequences. And here, we don't think that it's the intention of the department to have actually excluded it. It's just that it's drafted in that way. The general statement that we made about the poor drafting actually relates to not resolving the practical sectoral implications, and which we, in terms of, as we pointed with the water example, could, or land reform could actually result in unintended consequences, and we wouldn't want there to be further reasons for non-delivery. I think that answers all questions.
Thank you, ma'am. Ntate Hasmen.
Thank you, Chair. By follow-up on the two questions, maybe I must say that the one about NEDLAC agreement would need to be clarified between the department and yourselves, so that we know exactly what it is that you are referring to. And the second question on the service definition. On C, except, you know, perhaps beyond the view that perhaps there could be poor drafting, maybe it is my poor reading skills to say that C says any banking service or related or similar financial services or the undertaking, underwriting or assumption of any risk by one person on behalf of another, except to the extent that any such service, Roman figure 1 and 2. That's where my concern is. It seems to me those are excluded. Maybe it's my poor reading skills. I don't know. Thanks.
I think more like my poor understanding of listening skills. I wasn't. No, I didn't look at that second part. I think we'd need to be clarified by the department exactly how that would be differentiated from the other financial services. But as COSATA, we would lean more towards more stringent regulation, because if you're talking about financial services, it's areas where there has been a history of violation, and it also relates to a technical understanding, which often when people receive even documents in the mail about their own investments, pensions, whether it's pensions or provident fund, it's actually very difficult to decipher whether or not they're being shortchanged. So we would obviously argue for more stringent regulation for protection of recipients of these services on that basis.
Ms. Govender, thank you very much. Business connections. I would like to welcome you, sir, and I would like to extend my sincere apology. It was not my intention to keep you from breakfast until supper. I sincerely appreciate your fortitude to have stayed the journey. So when you are ready, we are in your able answer.
Jay, thank you. Everybody else, your patience as well. I surprised myself actually, sir, by staying. Business connection.